Nazism did not die in the ruins of Berlin in 1945, nor on the gallows at Nuremberg in 1946. It merely buried its uniform, slipped into mufti, and sauntered into the post-war world. Greetings from Prora.
This is Bristol. Well, actually, most of it is Bristol. It's just that I'm actually away over in Croatia this week. It's Friday. It's nearly 6 o'clock. Apologies. And most of the problems actually tonight were due to Firstbus, this wonderful privatised company that takes 1 hour and three quarters to get Dave, our sound engineer, home from work, where it should take around about 40 minutes. Tonight, one of the buses just dumped everybody and turned back, and so Dave had to get two buses to get home. We're streaming live in Bristol and in Croatia, which, with London's Inner Temple, Bristol is one of several Templar ports in the Empire of Lies. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream. We're at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the good old Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Please use Aurora and disable Google Play. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military propaganda psyops, boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions, and turning everything into a paid-for commodity, even the news bulletins, press releases, and military lies, puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs on the heroes. McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity or against World War III and wage slavery. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, the solutions to every crisis, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, farming, prisons, cost of living, climate, twisted Armageddonist accelerationist policies crafted to make every crisis worse. Nick Land's behaviourist Dark Enlightenment drones, the cowards and control freaks in their little aristocratic knighthood orders, want us as slaves to their AI. Albert Pike's World War III relies on your blind obedience, folks. Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Wef King Tampon Charlie and vampire queen Camilla wage war on the British people, as well as China, Russia and the BRICS. But it's not the end of the world, or is it? Helping us navigate the accelerationist Wef Fourth Reich matrix, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. This week we'll be looking at particularly at the Ukraine war and doing, I hope is a really thorough analysis of the resources that NATO is trying to grab in Ukraine off of what used to be a pro-Russian country. There's enormous amount of wealth in that country. And we will also be looking at the 9/11 anniversary and the links to the Israelis of 9/11. So, Martin, do you want to? Maybe we could just start with one of the sort of basic stories from this week, and that is the overreaction of the British police. It seems quite a lot of the time. Right-wing journalists apparently grassing up activists to the police. It was a modern-day equivalent, says Navarra Media, of a public flogging. While they were waiting for a police interview, Middlesbrough's solicitor, this is one of the activists, went online to discover the arrest had already hit the headlines. What is going on here? It'd been exposed by Max Parry from the Daily Express, who'd gone undercover within Palestine Action, disclosing plans, but it had been the Express that had passed evidence to the police. This is the Daily Express. So this is an article on Novara Media this week. Right-wing journalists keep grassing up the police. So why have we got journalists that are embedding themselves, infiltrating groups like Palestine Action, and then handing evidence that they're gathering whilst they're spying on them to the police so that these activists can be arrested?
Well, that's not the only case. There's a case in court at the moment of somebody who's accused of hate speech because they had a placard on one of the demonstrations showing Sunak and Braverman as coconuts, you know, in other words, black on the outside, white on the inside, which has been treated as if it's some kind of racial slur. But of course, the information for that, the police arrested her on the basis of a Twitter feed from a very right wing activist in the US. So what's actually happening is you've got pro-Israeli, anti-Palestinian journalists and activists who are infiltrating the movement and also observing the movement, just looking at things online, then passing it to the police. And what's really wrong about this, the police just go, thank you very much, and ignore it. What they are doing is they're picking up on this stuff and then taking it to court. Now, I suppose in the end of the day, if it goes to court, this can all come out. I mean, in actual fact, these people have done nothing wrong. The police are wasting our resources prosecuting people that shouldn't be prosecuted. But that is because we've got a very, very strong pro-Israel lobby working both in the US and Britain. And they've got lots of people that they employ.
I mean, can you imagine maybe one of the, say, the Daily Mail infiltrating the suffragettes and making sure that those actions never happened because the police came to arrest them before they ever set off?
Well, that's right. So we've had the special demonstration squad infiltrating all of our movements for years and years and years, which are, you know, professional undercover police officers. You've also got right-wing journalists and activists who are doing exactly the same thing and then trying to chivvy the police to pursue people, because that's what they think should be happening. In actual fact, I mean, the head of the board of deputies of British Jews has come out in totally in favour of the genocide that's being carried out by the Israeli army. Maybe he should be put on trial for incitement to murder. What about that? But of course, that isn't happening. It's our people who are being persecuted. But it's pretty clear which the direction, what's going on. And ultimately, if they put this stuff in front of juries, they're going to find that they're not going to get a conviction. And in actual fact, it's going to be a victory for us.
OK, well, we'll be hopefully joined on the line from the United States by ex-CIA analyst Larry Johnson in a minute to talk about Ukraine. But while we're waiting for Larry, I thought it'd be useful to have a look at from our first clip. Is from it's a UK clip from its title is MI5's Secret Role Revealed by SpyCop at Inquiry. And this is, I think, fascinating. It was actually Joe Banks that brought this to my attention and our attention generally. At the Inquiry, the feed is cut. So this is the SpyCop's Inquiry. One of the undercover police officers starts to talk about MI5's role in all of this, and then he's suddenly cut off. But it's great because they say that this information won't be in the transcript, but of course it is in the live recording from there. So let's have a listen to that now. MI5's secret role.
One black police officer who used the name has already been revealed by the Inquiry to have spied on the Lorraine Stevens killers to justice. His real name is Trevor Morris, and he spent 4 years pretending to be a left-wing. Then in his efforts to gather information on the Lawrence family's campaign, he deceived women into a long-term relationship using his fake identity. Trevor Morris has been giving further evidence at the Inquiry, which is live-streamed. Except as Morris was discussing the police's role in discrediting the Lawrence family, this happened.
Did he say anything to you to the effect that he'd been asked to gather intelligence with which to smear the Lawrence family?
I saw the... no disrespect to Peter, I thought nonsense. That's not what we're about. We're about gathering intelligence, not smearing individuals. That's a security service job. Let them do that. We're bothered about gathering intelligence. That's what we were doing.
Just to be clear.
Sorry, I shouldn't say that.
That's... Just to be clear, you are. Are you not in a position to say whether or not the security service was seeking to.
That was the Inquiry's stream cutting out. Just at the moment, the activities of the British security services were coming into view. And the stream was all suspended for almost an hour before inquiry chair John Mitting was broadcast making these remarks.
Ms. Barr, before you resume, may I say to those behind that there is a purpose in these orders. I know that they are serious orders. They do have a potentially serious consequence if they're breached. Please, I ask of you as well as demand of you, comply with what the order requires you to do. A transcript in due course will be published, which will contain part of that which was said between the hours of 11:16 and 11:22, but only part of it.
Yes, so that was a couple of months ago, but that was a live recording from the Spy Cops inquiry. What the undercover cop there was actually said was, it's not my job to smear the Lawrence family. That's a security service job. And then he was abruptly pulled up and told that he's not allowed to talk about, and the inquiry is not allowed to talk about anything relating to MI5, Martin.
Well, it's very revealing, isn't it? We know that the spy cops, the hundreds of them, have been infiltrated into the radical movement in this country over many years, were actually working with MI5. I mean, they're actually Metropolitan Police officers, most of them, but actually they're answering to the security services. And as I said in a moment of candour there, it's not my job to smear the Lawrence family who are campaigning about their boy being murdered. That's the job of the security services.
He's a black policeman. He's a black Metropolitan policeman. The idea, you know, I suppose from his point of view, he's there to protect the family, really. But he's implying that there are others who might not be quite so strict. So the idea is he's basically a decent guy. He's bringing in information, but that information will always be made available to other groups like the security services who might not necessarily be acting in the Lawrence family who had their son murdered's interest.
Well, I'm not saying he's, I don't think he's acting in the Lawrence family's interest either. He's basically, you know, he's being paid by the taxpayer to infiltrate a legitimate political organization which is campaigning about a murder, and he's collecting information on them. Now that's not, you know, there's no crime being committed by these people, so why is a police officer doing that? And that's because we have in fact got a police state here in various ways, and this is, you know, this stuff only came out by accident, but this inquiry, which has obviously been going on for months and years now, it's gradually in dribs and drabs coming out how completely infiltrated radical movements in this country have been by hundreds of police officers who actually had sexual relations and babies with some of the people they were targeting. I mean, it's like East Germany, except people don't realize it.
So we're also joined on the line now by Larry Johnson. Larry, would you like to just introduce yourself by way of telling us a little bit about your career?
Yeah, my background, I spent 4 years with the Central Intelligence Agency, 1985 to 89. During that time, I was in the what's known as the career trainee program for the first year, had full exposure to all aspects of the CIA, and then wound up as a senior analyst for Central America during the wars in Central America. I moved from CIA to State Department's Office of Counterterrorism, spent 4 years there. Left that office in 1993 and began a consulting business that I still have that business up and running. But the two things I focused on in that time frame was one, scripting terrorism exercises for U.S. military special operations forces, and then doing international financial investigations. One of the our clients was the European Union. We did an investigation on money laundering and tobacco companies, liquor companies. And under that investigation, as an example, Philip Morris made a settlement with the EU for $1.5 billion, which sounds like a lot of money. It is, but that turned out to be about a weak cash flow for Philip Morris. So, you know, they were like paying a speeding ticket. So I've got a background in intelligence, military affairs, and analysis. So I bring a pretty comprehensive view to things.
There's a few names pop into my mind, and you're talking about, you know, 1980s and the CIA. Is names like Philip Agee, John Stockwell, also the filmmaker Alan Frankovich, who was making films about the CIA at the time. Whilst you were within the Central Intelligence Agency, was there an awareness that there were people out there almost like spying on you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there were always, as long as you've got a bureaucratic organization, you're always at some point going to have whistleblowers and malcontents of some form or another. And just calling someone a malcontent is not intended to be a disparaging term. It's just, you know, people are not happy with the way things are. And, but Stockwell and Agee, I was aware of them, but they really didn't figure much in what I was doing.
If you were to just meet someone at a bar or in a pub, how would you explain the role of the Central Intelligence Agency to them as a whole?
A meddlesome mother-in-law, you know, one that has all the bad vices and telling you to not indulge in them. What the CIA was set up to do was to provide the president with some objective analysis. When Harry Truman established the CIA, at that point you had newspapers that were very much under the ownership of strong individuals with very decided political views about things, and accordingly would shape the news. The only good news back then was that there was enough diversity and competition that you would, it was tough to manage the message. What Truman was looking for was something that would provide objective insight. And as part of that was to also have a system in place for gathering intelligence from overseas so that we would absolutely know what the hell was going on in another country. That was the plan. But shortly after setting up the CIA, they decided that we ought to get involved in shaping affairs in other countries. And that gets into what's called covert action. And it's in the covert action field that the CIA really has been the most active over the years and the most destructive. During, if I recall the number correctly, during the administration of Dwight Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, which was 8 years, from 1952 to 1960, his term went from January of 53 until January of 61. There were over 170 covert actions carried out in 48 countries, and that included the overthrow of the government of Mossadegh in Iran in 1953. The overthrow of the government of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala in 1954, I believe it was. A lot of meddling in the internal affairs of other countries. That became sort of the hallmark. And throughout that period, the United States was particularly aggressive in trying to foment a civil war in the then Soviet Union and using Ukraine as a springboard for that.
Well, yes, and Ukraine, of course, is coming very much into everyone's views. Do you want to just give us your own take on how we got to where we are? We're listening on the news, scratching our heads with incredulity to various commentators saying, oh, just go and use these long-range missiles. Ukraine can use them now to hit in as far as they want into Russia. And the Russians saying, oh, well, that means that this is now a war with NATO. It's not just a war with Ukraine. So how did we get to this point?
Because we have a generation of Alzheimer's patients. You know, people have no historical memory. They have short attention spans. They don't pay attention to, world affairs. The West is angry with Vladimir Putin because he will not be our prison bitch. He will not submit to us and do what we want him to do, which is surrender Russia and turn over all the resources to the West. He's a little cantankerous in that regard. So, this really goes back to shortly after Putin took over from the wreckage of the collapse of the Soviet Union and then the government of Boris Yeltsin, which basically was selling off all of the resources and wealth of Russia to foreign oligarchs and creating a new class of Russian oligarchs. And, a significant number of them were Jewish. It's not hate speech to acknowledge that. It's just the reality. And I think it was 2001 that Putin convened a meeting at the Kremlin with these oligarchs. And he basically said, hey, this is going to be the deal going forward. You're going to stop selling off our country to these foreigners. If you insist on doing that, I'm going to put you in jail. But if you work on investing your money and resources here in Russia, I'll leave you alone and you can make money. You can continue to be wealthy. Most of them took the deal. Some, like Michael Khodorkovsky, didn't, and he wound up in prison. The second thing was Putin said, and you're not going to be involved with politics anymore. You're going to butt out. That started a revolution in Russia in which the society was literally transformed into a vibrant, thriving economy, one that was not full of oppression. It wasn't like the old Soviet days where people were literally in fear of being denounced and sent off to Siberia. It became a much more open society, but Putin actually delivered on making economic improvements to the lives of citizens.
I mean, wasn't Putin's challenge to these oligarchs, does it maybe have some resonance with what John F. Kennedy was planning to do in the 1960s with the, he was threatening particularly the CIA, but also the mob, saying, well, hang on a minute, guys, okay, so our family has made our money through you, but we're now deciding that we're going to try and put our house in order. Is there any kind of similarity between the two attitudes of Putin in 2000 and 1961 John F. Kennedy?
No, because I don't think Kennedy was really keen on that big of a reform. But Putin was, and you can see it. All you have to do is walk into any of the subway stations, the metro, the underground, in Moscow. It's like going into an art museum, an exquisite art museum. It's incredible. It's clean. It's efficient. The stores filled with goods. But throughout this period, the West had not given up on its desire to take control of Russia's vast natural resources, because Russia in the world is the number one, I think the United States number two, China number three, Ukraine, who we talked about in our correspondence, is number five, four or five, but the West was keen on taking control of Russia. And a part of that was to bring Ukraine into NATO. And Putin told the West very clearly in 2008, no. And that led the current CIA director, Bill Burns, who was then ambassador to Moscow, to write a cable. We call them cables, but it was a message sent electronically back, an email, if you will, to main states. And The Russian attitude is niet means niet, no means no. And yet, despite that clear marker that Putin put down, the West proceeded with provoking, encouraging, and backing Georgia to try to take territory inside Russia That led to a brief war in August of 2008, and Russia crushed Georgia. And so this continued until 2014, when the U.S. and the United Kingdom, so the CIA and MI6 got together, organized a coup, overthrew the government in Kiev that had been democratically elected, and then installed a new pro-Western government. And that new pro-Western government then proceeded to launch a civil war against the Donbass. And what people don't understand is the Donbass, historically within the Soviet Union, within Russia, I saw a poster. I was in Moscow in February. And this poster was made up in 1927, and it shows the Donbass region, but it appears like a heart with arteries and veins running in and out of it. And the expression in Russian is Donbass, Serce Rossiya, Donbass, the heart of Russia. And it literally is a manufacturing, mining, mineral heart of Russia. It was really a core of its industrial capability. And when the Ukrainian government in Kiev decided to launch these ethnic attacks, and they were going to prohibit people from speaking Russian, even though that they grew up speaking Russian. I mean, hell, even Zelensky, he grew up speaking Russian. He didn't grow up speaking Ukrainian. So when that attack started, that's why Russia went in and they conducted the election in Crimea. And the Crimeans said, nope, we don't want to be part of Ukraine. We want to go back to Mother Russia, which they did. And so this war that we're seeing now, it actually started in 2014. And, for 8 years until February of 2022, Ukraine, with the backing of the West, was conducting an attack on civilians and militias in Luhansk Republic and the Donetsk Republic. So that's what's brought us to this point, that finally Russia said enough, and they launched the counterattack to oust the Ukrainians. Both what they call the demilitarization and denazification. Because understand, I think it's going back to 2007. Every year from up until 2022, so 15 years, the United States and other NATO allies were conducting annual military exercises inside Ukraine. Now understand what I'm saying. Conducting military exercises with the Ukrainians, where the enemy was always Russia. Now, can you imagine let's say that Russia formed an alliance with the Scots and then decided to conduct annual military exercises in Scotland that were directed at England as the enemy? Do you think the Brits would stand for that? I don't. Similarly, in the United States, if Russia tried to do something like that with Mexico, we would use that as a casus belli. Well, for God's sake, we keep tweaking the damn bear, and then when we get surprised when the bear wakes up and wants to eat us. So that's what's been going on, and that's what's brought us to this point.
And it's getting a bit more serious, Larry, isn't it? Because we're now talking about when we saw 3 months ago, we saw the Ukrainians, ostensibly with a bit of help from NATO, taking out these early warning defense radars, taking out a command center, attacking an airfield in Russia. These are the sorts of strategic targets which the Russians argued are absolutely no use to the Ukrainians, but they most definitely are of use to NATO. So, for example, NATO might launch strategic nuclear weapons at Russia, and these radars would find those, but the Ukrainians don't have these to launch. So there's really no excuse This is a NATO target. It's not a Ukrainian target, however much you wanted to argue it. And now we're talking about these long-range weapons, which have been supplied only apparently to be used within Ukraine, now to be used against Russia.
Well, yes. Let's be clear that those reports about the attacks on the radars, I think, were grossly exaggerated. They didn't really do any significant damage, but it was showing sort of an intent on the part of Ukraine, but with NATO support. And yesterday, Vladimir Putin finally erased should have erased all doubt, because he came out very clearly and said, if NATO, if the United States or Britain or Germany, if they launch these strikes, if these missiles are launched and strike inside Russia, deep inside Russia, that it will be viewed by Russia as an act of war and Russia will respond accordingly. Russia will attack British targets. Russia will attack American targets. Made that very clear, which I think is one of the reasons that after some reports out of Prime Minister Starmer's office initially indicating that they were going to green light Ukraine for launching these strikes, that the news that came out late last night was, second thought, we're not going to do that. Because I think they realize now, you know, there's an acronym on the internet that stands FAFO. The cleaned up version is fool around, find out. The Russians gave a clear FAFO to both London and Washington that if they proceed with this, the response will be at them, not just at Ukraine. Now, I think while Russia is capable of escalating to using tactical nukes, I think they have some other options. Where they, for example, one of the first things they could do is destroy the satellite system that the West is using to target, to collect and provide targeting data to Ukraine.
And to these Western missiles. Let's just look at what Putin actually said yesterday. The article on antiwar.com is supporting long-range strikes on Russian territory would put NATO at war with Russia, quoting Putin, at war with Russia. Putin said on Thursday warnings against the US for allowing Ukraine to use NATO missiles in long-range strikes inside Russian territory, saying the move would put the Western military alliance at war with Russia. Yep. The comments came after Politico reported the White House was finalizing plans to expand the areas inside Russia where Ukraine can use US and British provided missiles. This would, says Putin, in a significant way change the very nature of the conflict. It would mean that NATO countries, the US, European countries, are at war with Russia. If that's the case, then taking into account the change of nature of the conflict, we will take the appropriate decisions based on the threats that we will face. He added that supporting long-range Ukrainian strikes inside Russian territory is a decision on whether NATO countries are directly involved in the military conflict or not. So this is pretty clear. So, you know, one of the things, you did a post on your blog, which I think, isn't it called sonar21.com, or maybe you're a contributor.
Sonar21.com, that's me.
Which really piqued my interest, because you rather sarcastically say, well, we all know that Ukraine is one of the poorest nations in Europe, or the poorest nation, and what it, you know, it certainly looks like it now with so much devastation in the east. But then you point out, actually, this is completely wrong. And this is what I love about analysts actually pulling out the facts, where, you know, the TV pictures might give you one impression. The fact is nothing like that, is it? Ukraine, you say, is not one of the worst off countries actually at all. And you run through some of the resources that there are in Ukraine. You say it's the first in Europe in proven recoverable uranium ore. It's the second in Europe and the 10th in the world in titanium ore reserves. It's the second in the world in terms of manganese ore, and has roughly 12% of the world's reserves. It's the second in iron ore reserves in the world. It's got around about 30 billion tonnes. The second in Europe in mercury. The third in Europe terms of shale gas reserves. The fourth place in the world in terms of the total value of natural resources. I mean, this place is an absolute mine, should we say, for Western corporations. So, but it might look poor right now, but I mean, and it's also known as a breadbasket, isn't it? So are there any of the this list that you've put up, which I'll share with our listeners on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, any of those statistics and particular resources that you think the West has got its beady eyes on?
All of them. I mean, why do you think BlackRock has poured more than $1 billion into investments to own Ukraine? Why do you think the West is so obsessed with Ukraine? You look at Russia and Ukraine side by side. One thing they share in common is both are resource-rich countries. And then when you realize that if you take Ukraine and fold it into Russia, there's no other country in the world that can match then that resource potential. And yet the different paths of development that have followed. Go to Russia today if you can. Go to Moscow. Go to St. Petersburg. The cities are modern. They're clean. The restaurants are superb. The stores are just filled with options and choices. It's a very, in terms of purchasing power parity, when they measure gross domestic product according to what your dollars will buy you, what your currency will buy you, Russia is in the top five. It's better than Germany. It's better than the United Kingdom. It's better than France. It's better than any country in Europe. It's quite wealthy. And compare that with Ukraine, which is considered the poorest country in Europe. How the hell is that possible? Because Ukraine, with all of this wealth, both in minerals, in metals, in agriculture, in natural and energy, it's not just in one area, it's across the board. They should be one of the wealthiest countries in the world. And they're not, because they've been used, they're basically the equivalent of a rape victim. They've been raped by the West, by the colonial powers. By the Brits,
Before 2014, Larry, surely the West wasn't able to. This was a east-leaning, Russian-leaning country.
Oh, no. Remember, starting in 1948-49, the CIA and British MI6 were actively involved in Ukraine, both recruiting and training insurgencies and guerrillas. So the United States and the Brits, they worked hand in glove on using Ukraine as a springboard to go against Russia itself. With the collapse in 1991, that just accelerated because the number of Western oligarchs that got their claws and hooks into Ukraine was just off the charts. I did a job with the Central Intelligence Agency back in 1994, where I accompanied a female CIA contractor. So the CIA at that point was it was a project where they were claiming that they were setting up business centers. So it was a commercial cover operation. They were setting up business centers, but the purpose of those business centers was to try to identify families, individuals that had ties into the former KGB. But as part of that trip, when I was there, we got to visit a former factory. It turned out they, they made SS-21 warheads at this factory. And what they had done was they had literally transformed some of the equipment into a pizza oven, and were building a pizza oven. And so it was a time of great upheaval, and the soldiers that were walking around the streets, and again, this was 30 years ago. The soldiers walking around the streets were in threadbare uniforms, and the boots they had on looked like they'd been overused. Ukraine was suffering. They had a very active black market for just buying something as simple as gasoline. I remember the fellow that was driving me around, he looked like a walking human refrigerator. He was former Spetsnaz. And one morning we were taking the circuitous route. And I was worried that he was going to take me under a bridge and dispose of me. But it turned out that he was looking for gas. And it was all of the gas being sold on the black market. So, that was Ukraine back then. But then, the level of corruption, what's going on there today, is just off the charts. And unlike Russia, I don't want to hear anybody in Britain or the United States talk about corruption in these other countries, because good God, look at Hunter Biden and Joe Biden. Then come back and talk to me about corruption. I mean, the United States is just as bad, just as guilty as some of these other places, but we like to get all sanctimonious and you sit on our moral high horse and criticize them. But what we have seen in Russia over the last 3 months, a lot of senior military guys have been arrested and are facing charges on corruption because they were profiting off of the war and taking advantage of the troops. At least, I haven't seen too many going to jail here in the United States or in Ukraine.
Larry, it's brilliant you taking us back to the 1990s, because this was such a fascinating period in the Eastern Bloc, the old Warsaw Pact area. Now, our own journalist, originally a New Zealander, Roger Cook, working for the BBC and then Central Television, he went out there and he made a program called Dirty Bomb, where he was doing undercover filming. It was a journalistic sting, in order to get information, in fact, to get hold of weapons-grade plutonium from in Moscow, from these people who were connected with the military and hadn't been paid for months. And they were just looking to dispose of anything that they could get, that they had their hands on, including, and he did get hold of weapons-grade plutonium, which was then tested. But just as he was about to leave Moscow, they said to him, well, why don't you just, why can't we just sell you one of these SS-20 systems? Because, you don't have to make it into a bomb. This is all ready to go. And they lifted up the tarpaulin, and there was an SS-20 launcher with warheads. I mean, this does make you think that maybe this whole idea of weapons, nuclear weapons out there on the black market, was much bigger in the 90s than we realize.
Yeah. Well, in fact, that was what was when we went to that one building to look at what we were told was going to be a pizza oven. And the building itself reminded me of the U.S. main State Department building. And you walked into this, entry hallway. And then as we went down a corridor, and, the corridor was probably 100, 200 meters long. And as you're walking along, you could smell the toilets, which is sort of an odd, sensation. But also about every 20 meters or so, there was a grate, a metal grate in the floor. And we'd walk over that and I wonder, huh? And so when we came into this room, you could literally smell the heat coming off of the oven. I mean, it was heated up. And then I looked around the room, and there are what are called radioactive glove boxes. So, if anybody's seen a premature baby in a nursery, they have these, they're in this plastic shell, and people can put their arms in through gloves. So these were boxes for handling radioactive material. And it had the radioactive sign on the side of it. I'm going, good Lord, what have we gotten ourselves into? And then they proceeded to show us this pizza oven, and it had a massive electronics box, or a box on the side to contain electronic, all the components. But, you know, and I'd say it was probably, you know, 1 meter by 2 meters in size. So it's fairly, you know, fairly large, and or one by 1.5 meters. And but when you opened it up, the electronic components that were running this pizza oven were just up in one corner. It was just, what they were doing was cannibalizing everything they had. And I did ask him. I said, "Well, what did you guys make here before this?" And the answer was SS-21 warhead. So, you know, yeah, there was. These people were facing economic survival. I mean, it was literally they were struggling to figure out how to stay afloat. And when you get people into that kind of desperate situation, they'll do anything.
Martin Summers, I hope you're still with us. Martin, you were actually also out in Eastern Europe, I know, weren't you? Doing work, looking at the potential for a kind of Western style, the economy, you know, the economy was in a terrible state, and that's so. Martin, can you just say what your experience was of Eastern Europe, and I think were you in Poland and.
Well, I originally started working in Eastern Europe in 1991. For the New Economics Foundation. So I've been teaching economics, and then, of course, the Berlin Wall came down, things changed, and I applied to be the East European desk officer for the New Economics Foundation, just sort of left of centre, green.
I mean, did you see any evidence of the sort of activity Larry's describing there with these Western intelligence services looking around and seeing, right, okay, let's just start cataloguing all of this, and hopefully the West can take it over?
Well, I mean, the whole economic reform was very badly conceived. As Larry Johnson, I follow your blog closely, Larry, by the way, so it's great to have you on here.
Oh, thanks so much.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're one of the people I read every day. You will know Jeffrey Sachs, who was at the time, he was a much more senior person than I was. I was very, very lowly. You know, I was just trying to get in the game, really, on behalf of my employers, going to conferences, trying to find out what was going on. He was obviously much more senior. He advised the Polish government, and then he advised the Russian government on the economic reform. But, of course, he's come out very in recent years and recent times saying how badly conceived it all was. How, you know, it was just stupid, a lot of what went down. And of course, what was actually happening in Russia was that and in Ukraine was a sort of meltdown of industrial society. So lots of, you know, critical infrastructure was like railway lines and electricity pylons was being was being totted out, as we call it in England, and then sold off as scrap through the Baltic states.
And, I mean, you could, Martin, look at the United States and Britain and say, well, actually, we've been deindustrialized. You've got these massive private equity firms taking over that. What the Russians did is we're saying we're not going to have that happen here.
Well, what happened was they actually did the transition shock in the Soviet Union proper was far worse than anything we saw here or in the US. I mean, it's pretty bad in both countries, but it was a grinder process, you know, the miners' strike here and so on and so forth. It was all done overnight there, and it was totally misconceived. I mean, I did actually argue this at the time, and I wrote a book with a Hungarian economist about this, which came out in 1998. He went on to be Laszlo Andor, he went on to be a European commissioner. But I mean, basically, the whole thing was misconceived. And I remember talking to someone from the British government at the time when I was back in London. I said, well, why are they doing this? Is it because they believe all this free market nonsense? Or is it because they're trying to destroy the Russians as a potential military threat? And he said, it's both of those things and something you haven't mentioned. Some people are making an awful lot of money out of this. And that was the whole process was very destructive. But as Larry pointed out, the Russians managed to pull the plane out of the dive and they've and moved, and you know, and you can see the difference in Ukraine and Russia today. Ukraine carried on following the same old silly policies, and they've ended up where they've ended up. Russia decided to change its direction, and they've very successfully.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? You've also got next door to Ukraine, Martin, you've got Belarus, which has taken a different path, a more eastern-leaning Russian path. Right, well, just getting back to Larry's blog, you talk a lot about the agriculture, which is very close to my heart, Larry. The first in Europe in terms of arable land area, the biggest. That is, you know, obviously there are other countries, a lot of them are mountainous. They are not. They have a massive arable land area. The third place in the world by area was that Chernozem? What does that mean?
Chernozem.
Yeah, I'm not sure what that means. I saw that and I was like, it may have just
okay, that's a mystery.
Title.
We'll have to figure out later. First in the world for export of sunflower and sunflower oil, second for barley production, fourth in the world for barley export, third largest producer and fourth largest exporter of corn in the entire world, the fourth largest potato producer, the fifth largest rye producer. I'm not even sure that we produce rye much in Britain at all anymore. Honey production, fifth in the world, eighth for wheat exports. I mean, they are quite well known, aren't they, Larry, for wheat, particularly in grain, and seen as a massive export market.
Yeah, this was so. These numbers are pre-February 2022, because since particularly with the war raging in the Donbass, I wouldn't want to be a farmer out in the fields trying to plow, because good Lord knows what you're going to plow up in terms of a mine or getting hit with a drone or facing a bomb coming in. But there's no denying that there are some countries that are known for only, like Saudi Arabia. Well, Saudi Arabia is not producing potatoes and corn, right? They do oil. That's it. Similarly, like even Venezuela, Nigeria. So you get these countries that are known for being oil producers. Well, here you have Ukraine, which is, they do it all. You know, they do it on the agriculture side. They do it with metals. They do it with minerals. They do it with energy. And so, by any definition, they should be one of the wealthiest, most productive countries. It would make sense to bet on them from an economic standpoint. But this is where we get to these power relationships. Who actually controls? Who's making the decisions? And are those decisions being made in the best interest of their citizens? And you look at what's happening, right now in the United Kingdom and in the United States. Both countries, when you go back to World War II, had an industrial base that was able to operate and played an important role. The industrial base in the United States was far grander in scale than anything in the UK. But back then, the UK was still pretty robust in its ability to produce steel, for example. But now, over the course of the last 30 years, those industrial capabilities have been stripped. And when you're stripping those industrial capabilities, you're taking jobs away from people who are really, I call it the backbone of those societies. I look back in my own life. So, I graduated from high school about 50 years ago. And when I graduated, my father was a machinist foreman at Armco Steel, previously known as Sheffield Steel. One of my other classmates, his father was a production foreman at Standard Oil Corporation. They had a Standard Oil refinery there in the Independence, Missouri, Sugar Creek, Missouri area. Others' parents worked at Bendix Corporation. Others at Alice Chalmers, where they produced farm implements. Others at Leeds Plant for General Motors, where they produced automobiles. When I went back for the 50th high school reunion, none of those plants were there operating. So the point is that when you have that kind of wealth that can be generated for workers, back then you know, I wasn't from a wealthy family, but, you know, my dad could afford a new car every 2 or 3 years. We could take a family vacation. We had a modest home, but there was enough money to sustain a stable, solid middle class. Well, that's not what's happening now in the United States. That's not what's happening in the UK. And you see this growing gap between those who are, let's call it the worker class, and those who are the financial class. Enormous gaps. It's beginning to mirror and look like Ukraine. And that's not a good look.
Well, so, okay, so what is in it for us? I'm talking about us as citizens of the United Kingdom, or sorry, subjects, and of the United States. What's in it for us, this war? I mean, I can't imagine great queues of people wanting out to go and join the army and fight Russia.
Well, I tell you what's in it for you. As long as you're a shareholder, as long as you hold stock in Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, or Raytheon Corporation, then you are doing just fine. Because those stocks have basically, I think, for example, Northrop Grumman, its stock back in January of 2022 was about $270. Now it's over $520. Okay? So this is about making money for these corporations. And those who hold stock in those corporations making out like bandits, laughing all the way to the bank.
So, I mean, what you're saying is simply, in a nutshell, is that the shift over the last 20, 30 years has been away from manufacturing for peace to manufacturing for war in the West.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The military-industrial complex, when you look at the history of the United States in this regard, we've been at war almost continuously since 1956, 57, when we started, 50. We go to war in Korea, come out of Korea, then we get embroiled in Vietnam, and then Vietnam goes off the rails, but we continue. Then we get involved with Central America, and then we're involved with Africa, and then, you know, so it goes on and on. We keep looking for a new enemy. And all the time, you know, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, at that point, we should have said, hey, we've won the Cold War. We no longer have to worry about a Soviet threat, a Soviet international communism taking over the planet. We were already in a diplomatic relationship with China, so we didn't have to worry about the Chinese conquering anything. And so at that point, we could have cut our defense spending and redirected that defense spending to building up infrastructure, making sure that every child was properly educated. But instead, we decided, we struggled for a few years trying to figure out a new enemy, and then we found terrorism. And so the global war on terror became the driving incentive, and the defense budget continued to grow and creep up. And now once the war on terror has sort of petered out, it's back to it's Russia, it's China, it's Iran. Russia, China, Iran, oh my, you know, lions, tigers, and bears. And that becomes the driving force to justify now the U.S. defense budget is approaching $900 billion. And some argue that, in fact, if you go through the actual expenses, it's probably closer to $1.2 trillion. Enormous amount of money. That's six times what Russia and China spend together on their defense needs. So this is all about corruption in the United States. I don't know if you've spent any time over the last 30 years in Washington, D.C. I first moved there in 1979, so 45 years ago. And when my wife and I first moved there, we lived in Chevy Chase, Maryland, near the National Institutes of Health. And at that time, you didn't have these McMansions. The property was not selling for millions of dollars there in downtown Bethesda and Chevy Chase. You didn't have Lamborghini dealerships, Bentley dealerships, Ferrari dealerships. That was considered some strange European thing. The upscale automobile, if you got one, was Mercedes-Benz. Now today, you go to Washington, D.C., the money is washing over that like the tsunami did over Thailand back when it got flooded. It is, you've got Lamborghini, Rolls-Royce. They've got Rolls-Royce dealerships there. Bentleys as well. Bugatti. You got cars that are, you go purchase a car for $300,000-$400,000. You've got the property is off the charts. Well, what's changed? Washington, D.C. doesn't produce anything. It's not like there are factories out there. What it sells is influence, access to power, and this ability to cut sweetheart deals and take control of resources of foreign countries. Yeah. And so here is this, the sick, I'll call it a sick imperialist policy on the part of the West. And it's coming unraveled right now, because at the very time that we're dependent upon being able to essentially rape other countries, those other countries are standing up together and saying, no. This program of systematic rape is going to stop. And that's why you've got BRICS. And that's why you've got nations around the global South lining up to say, hey, we're going with them. And they're telling the United States and Britain to sod off.
At the end of the day, though, of course, the NATO countries aren't going to have that. They're going to say, well, we're going to have to hang on. I'm just looking at a Bloomberg article this week. Morgan Stanley sees the euro sliding 7% on the risk of big European Central Bank cuts. Morgan Stanley is saying that the euro could slide towards parity with the dollar within just a couple of months on the risk markets are moving to price in more aggressive policy easing, whatever that means, by the European Central Bank to tackling a faltering economy. So it does seem as if, over the last couple of years, for whatever reason, Europe has not really been able to manage its economy successfully, and we're having to buy from Europe a lot of our stuff from the States, not least of which, of course, is energy, Larry.
Yeah. Well, that was part of the reason the United States blew up Nord Stream pipeline. We wanted to become the sole supplier of your cocaine, natural gas. But, as long as Russia was there able to supply natural gas to Germany and to the rest of Europe at a very low cost, because there were not huge transportation costs built in, it made it difficult for the United States to compete. Well, we can't have that. United States is, if we can't win it by merit, well, by God, we're gonna get the fix in. And it's just like how the mob acts. They tell you to pay the protection money. If you don't pay the protection money, we're gonna come set your pizzeria on fire. And next time, maybe you'll pay the protection money. So that's what's going on. And the real irony of all of this is that the more, what sapped the British Empire was its constant involvement in foreign wars. And World War I was really what sort of gutted the ability of the UK to maintain its empire status. World War II was sort of the icing on the cake of saying, okay, hey, that colonial era is over. You still got the trappings. You can still dress up in the costumes. But in terms of actually having the clout, the military clout to make something happen, that's gone. If you back in the, was it 54, when the Brits got together with the Israelis and decided to take over the Suez Canal, and Dwight Eisenhower told everybody, hey, back in your lane, get back in, climb back into your box, and everybody obeyed, because, none were powerful enough to resist the United States back then.
Well, let's go back up to now and looking towards this U.S. presidential election, Larry, because we've got a clip to play. And so this is from the debate this week. It's around about 5 minutes, but it's both of the candidates, Harris and Trump, giving their opinions on Ukraine. So, yeah, we've got a sort of section today where we're looking at the USA and the presidential debate. And this is, we're going to be hearing the first one, which is from Gaza, later. But as you're on, I think it'd be useful to have a listen to the two candidates discussing Ukraine now.
I want to turn to the war in Ukraine. Into this conflict. Mr. President, it has been the position of the Biden administration that we must defend Ukraine from Russia, from Vladimir Putin, to defend their sovereignty, their democracy, that it's in America's best interest to do so, arguing that if Putin wins, he may be emboldened to move even further into other countries. You have said you would solve this war in 24 hours. You said so just before the break tonight. How exactly would you do that? A very simple question tonight. Do you want Ukraine to win this war?
I want the war to stop. I want to save lives that are being uselessly, people being millions. It's the millions. It's so much worse than the numbers that you're getting, which are fake numbers. Look, we're in for $250 billion or more because they don't ask Europe, which is a much bigger beneficiary to getting this thing done than we are. We're in for $150 billion less. And you don't have the courage to ask Europe like I did with NATO. They paid billions and billions, hundreds of billions of dollars when I said, either you pay up or we're not going to protect you anymore. So that's maybe one of the reasons they don't like me as much as they like weak people. But you take a look at what's happening. We're in for $250 to $275 billion. They're into $100 to $150. They should be forced to equalize. With that being said, I want to get the war settled. I know Zelensky very well, and I know Putin very well. I have a good relationship, and they respect your president, okay? They respect me. They don't respect Biden. How would you respect him? Why? For what reason? He hasn't even made a phone call in 2 years to Putin, hasn't spoken to anybody. They don't even try and get it. That is a war that's dying to be settled. I will get it settled before I even become president. If I win, when I'm president-elect, and what I'll do is I'll speak to one, I'll speak to the other, I'll get them together. That war would have never happened. And in fact, when I saw Putin after I left, unfortunately left because our country has gone to hell. But after I left, when I saw him building up soldiers, he did it after I left. I said, oh, he must be negotiating. It must be a good, strong point of negotiation. Well, it wasn't, because Biden had no idea how to talk to him. He had no idea how to stop it. And now you have millions of people dead, and it's only getting worse, and it could lead to World War III. Don't kid yourself, David. We're playing with World War III, and we have a president that we don't even know if he's – where is our president? We don't even know if he's a president.
And just to clarify,
they
here –
they threw him out of a campaign like a dog. We don't even know. Is he our president? But we have a president,
Mr. President,
that doesn't know he's alive.
Your time is up. Just to clarify in the question, do you believe it's in the U.S. best interest for Ukraine to win this war, yes or no?
I think it's the U.S. best interest to get this war finished and just get it done.
All right.
Negotiate a deal, because we have to stop all of these human lives from being destroyed.
I want to take this to Vice President Harris. I want to get your thoughts on support for Ukraine in this moment, but also, as commander-in-chief, if elected, how would you deal with Vladimir Putin, and would it be any different from what we're seeing from President Biden?
Well, first of all, it's important to remind the former president, you're not running against Joe Biden, you're running against me. I believe the reason that Donald Trump says that this war would be over within 24 hours is because he would just give it up. And that's not who we are as Americans. Let's understand what happened here. I actually met with Zelensky a few days before Russia invaded, tried through force to change territorial boundaries, to defy one of the most important international rules and norms, which is the importance of sovereignty and territorial integrity. And I met with President Zelensky. I shared with him American intelligence about how he could defend himself. Days later, I went to NATO's eastern flank, to Poland and Romania. And through the work that I and others did, we brought 50 countries together to support Ukraine in its righteous defense. And because of our support, because of the air defense, the ammunition, the artillery, the javelins, the Abrams tanks that we have provided, Ukraine stands as an independent and free country. If Donald Trump were president, Putin would be sitting in Kyiv right now. And understand what that would mean, because Putin's agenda is not just about Ukraine. Understand why the European allies and our NATO allies are so thankful that you are no longer president, and that we understand the importance of the greatest military alliance the world has ever known, which is NATO, and what we have done to preserve the ability of Zelensky and the Ukrainians to fight for their independence. Otherwise, Putin would be sitting in Kyiv with his eyes on the rest of Europe, starting with Poland. And why don't you tell the 800,000 Polish Americans right here in Pennsylvania how quickly you would give up for the sake of favor and what you think is a friendship with what is known to be a dictator who would eat you for lunch.
Well, there you go. Two contenders to be the emperor at the end of this year. Larry.
Yes.
Well, what do you make of the obvious thing is, who's going to win?
Well, if it's a fair contest, Trump's going to win. It depends what level of cheating there is and fraud, and whether or not the Republicans will get their act together to prevent that. What you're hearing from Kamala Harris is, she's not making the decision. She's just going to be following orders, just like Joe Biden has been. This is all a grift. This is all about making money. And the only thing that they can argue is that any attempt that Trump makes to try to get the war settled and stopped is going to lead to accusations that he is the boyfriend, the romantic interest of Vladimir Putin, that he's in Putin's pocket, that he's under Putin's control. And see, that's one of the things that's so damn dangerous right now in this country, that none of the major political figures can stand up and be given, they will not be given a platform to make the case that Russia's not our enemy, that this narrative about Ukraine fighting for its freedom is just complete bullshit. That the reality is what we're witnessing is a failed U.S.-NATO attempt to try to conquer Russia and take control of Russia's resources in the same way that BlackRock is teed up to take control of Ukraine's resources. That's what this is all about. You know, what fascinates me is if you listen to the number of commentators about, they got to get rid of Vladimir Putin. Putin's got to go. We want to weaken Putin. Putin's got to go. I go, okay, well, if Putin goes, then what? You think somebody weak and malleable and under control of the West is going to be allowed to take control in Russia? Think again. Putin is the adult in the room who recognizes the danger of plunging this contest, getting plunged into a global war. Now, the nobody wants to say this or hear this, but here are the facts. Russia has a robust anti-ballistic missile defense capability. Russia has the ability to shoot down U.S., British, French ballistic missiles if launched at Russia. By contrast, neither the French, the Brits, or the Americans have any anti-ballistic missile defense. Zero. And the reality is Russia could fight and win a nuclear war. People don't like to go there, but that's the reality. Would Russia suffer some damage? Oh, probably. But nothing that would devastate and destroy it as a country. The West, though, would be destroyed. And that's in the back of, that's in the back of Putin's mind in all of this. That's the very last place he wants to go.
Is it in the back of the minds of the military that we in Britain and the United States trust to protect us?
Oh, hell no. No, look. They're still indulging in these fantasies. I mean, you listen to the number of, it's like a, contest to see who can demonstrate the most ignorance between former British military officers and former American senior general officers. You know, we've got David Petraeus and Ben Hodges and General Jack Keane. You know, they all indulge this fantasy that Ukraine's got some robust, enormous military capabilities that they simply don't have. And all the while dismissing Russia as some sort of backward, awkward, incompetent group of fools. And yet here is the we've got a bunch of data points we can look at. When the Soviets withdrew from Afghanistan in 1988, they did so over about an eight-month period starting in February. They withdrew. They didn't have any mass casualty events. They got out of the country on amicable terms. The government they left behind in charge lasted for 3 years. Compare that with the United States, which in August of 2021, it looked like a reprise of the escape from Saigon in, what was that, April of 1975. A complete collapse of the government and casualties and chaos. So, you know, the Western military, whether we're talking the United States or British, is a joke. I mean, hell, the Brits can't even get an aircraft carrier out of harbor without it breaking down these days.
That's right. So, no, well, that's quite true. Look, let's just talk finally about the election coming up. I mean, it's pretty clear on Ukraine anyway. Trump just wants to get a deal struck, which would be a ceasefire and then some kind of line along where the line of combat now is between Russia and Ukraine. And finish it. And Harris wants to carry it on. That's pretty clear. Yeah. But it turns out that there's something called the Transatlantic Commission on Election Integrity, which is designed to check all of these elections, make sure they're all fine. But anyway, these are an unelected bunch, including the former Secretary General of NATO and a guy called Viktor Pinchuk, who was a key individual in the Ukraine coup. So I'll put a link up to them. I mean, we were hearing... from Mike Benz last week about this organization, fascinating bunch, the TCEI, which are supposed to safeguard our elections, are actually run by ex-intelligence people and ex-NATO heads and oligarchs. So that's obviously not going to quite your elections won't be have much integrity with these guys around. But more importantly, Larry, something about it worries me about election fixing. There's a great article NBC News came out with recently about online vulnerabilities. Experts finding nearly three dozen US voting systems, not just individual voting machines, whole systems are actually connected to the internet, even though the researchers were told that none of them connected to the internet. When they had a very close look, they found actually they were.
Yeah, well, I mean, look.
I mean, this obviously, you know, there could be hacking going on during the election. Isn't it a good idea to just go over to the old-fashioned paper ballot?
Yeah, we should. We're Zimbabwe, you know. Actually, Zimbabwe makes us looks good compared to what we do in terms of how we run elections in this country. You know, the United States would give a banana republic a bad name. It's absurd to be caught in a situation where the opportunity for fraudulent votes is endemic to the system, and it is unlikely to be fixed by November. What I think is there is the possibility of this conflict widening, breaking out into war with Russia, or the United States get embroiled in a war in the Middle East with Iran. And or Hezbollah, or even less likely, but still on the table of possibilities, is war with China. In either of those scenarios, what's going to happen is the United States is going to face a pretty rapid defeat because there is no depth anymore to the U.S. capabilities. Look at the Houthis defeated the U.S. Navy. We deployed a carrier task force group to the Red Sea. We were going to bomb those Houthis into submission, to reopen the Red Sea route and make it freedom of navigation. And what happened? We had to ultimately pull the carrier task force group out because, well, they couldn't sustain. They couldn't stay in operation there. They needed to go refit, refuel, get a new crew. So they had to sail away, and the Houthis are still running the show. So if the mighty United States Navy with its British and German and French allies can't defeat the Houthis, and what world of fantasy do you believe that you could take on the Russians and or the Chinese or both at the same time? I mean, good Lord.
Okay, but hang on. Yeah, I mean, let me just put a scenario for November to you. Say Kamala Harris wins by a very thin margin, and millions of Republicans then say, well, hang on, you've just cheated at this election. And maybe they may actually have the evidence for it too. I mean, isn't this going to, be perfect in a way for the deep state? Because they will say, well, Harris has won. I'm very sorry, but anyone that protests against it is going to jail.
Yeah, yeah. No, hey, we've become the Soviet Union. The United States that made its bones by being a revolutionary society and breaking away from the rule of Great Britain starting in 1776, has now become the very thing that we rebelled against. And we're behaving and imposing the same kind of Stalinist policies that we saw rife during the Soviet Union, during the bad old days of the Cold War. So, yeah, there's... there is no moral consistency on this side of the ocean, and it's all about running this program of demonization against Donald Trump. But let me be clear, I'm not arguing that Donald Trump's a great thinker or a great leader. He's a very flawed individual. But the one thing to his advantage, he's not corrupt. He doesn't need to come to Washington, D.C. to get on the gravy train and start feeding at the trough. He's the one that actually got poorer by coming to D.C., unlike Bill Clinton, unlike George W. Bush, unlike Barack Obama, unlike Joe Biden. It goes on. Unlike Dick Cheney. I mean, go down the list of this house of incest that is the Washington, D.C. But Trump at least understands that there is something called an interest in putting America first. And that starts with getting us out of these forever wars. But unfortunately, I think if Harris and her team gets in, the United States is going to destroy itself. And we'll take Great Britain and the rest of Europe down with us.
So your blog is called sonar21.com. But I'm sorry, I can't resist but ask you, Larry, about this week. Germany, France and the UK have been imposing sanctions on Iran. Because Iran is trading with Russia. Yeah. Now, of course, there are many people who are calling for sanctions on Israel, aren't there, for the genocide?
Yeah. Well, look, the reality is, if you look at the history of sanctions, I'm not aware of I guess there's only one case we can point to where sanctions appeared to be effective in forcing a change in government policy. And those were the sanctions imposed on South Africa for its apartheid policies. Apart from that, economic sanctions alone changed people's economic incentives. And what we've seen as a result of the sanctions that were enforced on Russia has been led to the strengthening of BRICS and a dramatic move away from the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency. It's really changing the international economic order before our eyes. We're seeing some pretty dramatic moves in that regard.
Okay, Jarek, Larry Johnson, sonar21.com. Thanks ever so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you, Tony. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you and your audience.
Okay, fantastic. Now, Martin, let's move to look at the Gaza section of the US presidential debate this week on ABC. I don't know if there's anything you want to pick up on what Larry was saying there, but I mean, he's quite clear that there's an enormous difference between Harris and Trump over Ukraine. In fact, they're both spilling it out, aren't they?
Yeah, there's I don't think there's that much of a difference from my point of view. You see, the presumption is that the Russians will want to negotiate, and in actual fact, they don't trust the West. They don't trust Trump. They don't trust anybody in the West.
Isn't that the West under Biden?
They don't. Well, they're not. Nobody's negotiating at the moment. As Trump pointed out in his contribution earlier, there's not been a phone call in 2.5 years. Now, he can pick up the phone and he can phone Putin, and Putin might even answer, but he's not going to give Trump what he wants either, because in actual fact, the Americans don't know how to negotiate.
Putin has said that he's backing Kamala Harris, hasn't he?
Sorry?
Putin has said he's backing Kamala Harris.
Well, I think that's Putin being trolling, basically. I mean, what he's saying is, don't imagine that if you vote for Trump, it's going to end the war, because it isn't. Because the war isn't with Trump and it isn't with Kamala Harris, it's with the deep state.
Very interesting. Well, that's an interesting take. Anyway, let's have a listen now to the clip from the presidential debate that took place this week in the United States to find out who is going to be our new emperor in the Western world, the king of the heap. And this is the section which was just before the one we heard just now, and this is on Gaza.
Turning now to the Israel-Hamas war and the hostages who are still being held, Americans among them. Vice President Harris, in December, you said, quote, Israel has a right to defend itself, but you added, quote, it matters how, saying international humanitarian law must be respected. Israel must do more to protect innocent civilians. You said that 9 months ago. Now an estimated 40,000 Palestinians are dead. Nearly 100 hostages remain. Just last week, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said there's not a deal in the making. President Biden has not been able to break through the stalemate. How would you do it?
Well, let's understand how we got here. On October 7, Hamas, a terrorist organization, slaughtered 1,200 Israelis. Many of them young people who were simply attending a concert. Women were horribly raped. And so absolutely, I said then, and I say now, Israel has a right to defend itself. We would. And how it does so matters. Because it is also true, far too many innocent Palestinians have been killed. Children, mothers. What we know is that this war must end. It must win. And immediately, and the way it will end is we need a ceasefire deal and we need the hostages out. And so we will continue to work around the clock on that. Work around the clock, also understanding that we must chart a course for a two-state solution. And in that solution, there must be security for the Israeli people and Israel, and in equal measure for the Palestinians. But the one thing I will assure you always, I will always give Israel the ability to defend itself, in particular as it relates to Iran and any threat that Iran and its proxies pose to Israel. But we must have a two-state solution where we can rebuild Gaza, where the Palestinians have security, self-determination, and the dignity they so rightly deserve.
President Trump, how would you negotiate with Netanyahu and also Hamas in order to get the hostages out and prevent the killing of more innocent civilians in Gaza?
If I were president, it would have never started. If I were president, Russia would have never, ever. I know Putin very well. He would have never, and there was no threat of it either, by the way, for 4 years, have gone into Ukraine and killed millions of people when you add it up, far worse than people understand what's going on over there. But when she mentions about Israel, all of a sudden, she hates Israel. She wouldn't even meet with Netanyahu when he went to Congress to make a very important speech. She refused to be there because she was at a sorority party of hers. She wanted to go to the sorority party. She hates Israel. If she's president, I believe that Israel will not exist within 2 years from now. And I've been pretty good at predictions, and I hope I'm wrong about that one. She hates Israel. At the same time, in her own way, she hates the Arab population because the whole place is going to get blown up. Arabs, Jewish people, Israel. Israel will be gone. It would have never happened. Iran was broke under Donald Trump. Now Iran has $300 billion because they took off all the sanctions that I had. Iran had no money for Hamas or Hezbollah or any of the 28 different spheres of terror. And they are spheres of terror, horrible terror. They had no money. It was a big story, and you know it. You covered it very well, actually. They had no money for terror. They were broke. Now they're a rich nation. And now what they're doing is they're spreading that money around. Look at what's happening with the Houthis and Yemen. Look at what's going on in the Middle East. This would have never happened. I will get that settled and fast, and I'll get the war with Ukraine and Russia ended. If I'm president-elect, I'll get it done before even becoming president.
Vice President Harris, he says you hate Israel.
That's absolutely not true. I have my entire career and life supported Israel and the Israeli people. He knows that. He's trying to, again, divide and distract from the reality, which is it is very well known that Donald Trump is weak and wrong on national security and foreign policy. It is well known that he admires dictators, wants to be a dictator on day one, according to himself. It is well known that he said of Putin that he can do whatever the hell he wants and go into Ukraine. It is well known that he said when Russia went into Ukraine, it was brilliant. It is well known he exchanged love letters with Kim Jong-un. And it is absolutely well known that these dictators and autocrats are rooting for you to be president again because they're so clear they can manipulate you with flattery and favors. And that is why so many military leaders who you have worked with have told me you are a disgrace. That is why we understand that we have to have a president who is not consistently weak and wrong on national security, including the importance of upholding and respecting in highest regard our military.
Vice President Harris, thank you.
And she's the one that caused it. That's weak on national security by allowing every nation last month for the year, 168 different people into our country. Their crime rates are way down. Putin endorsed her last week, said, I hope she wins. And I think he meant it because what he's gotten away with is absolutely incredible. It wouldn't have happened with me. These other countries think that they're weak and incompetent, and they are. They're grossly incompetent. And I just ask one question. Why does Biden go in and kill the Keystone Pipeline and approve the single biggest deal that Russia's ever made, Nord Stream 2, the biggest pipeline anywhere in the world going to Germany and all over Europe? Because they're weak and they're ineffective. And Biden, by the way,
President
gets paid
Trump,
a lot of money.
Thank you. We have a lot of issues to get to.
Well, that was interesting what he was saying at the end there, Martin, as well, about Nord Stream. It's almost like Biden's approved Nord Stream, but somebody else decided to knock it out, you know. But I don't know if most of the American audience really understand anything about Nord Stream and its importance. But anyway, what do you make of that exchange there?
Well, it's very depressing, isn't it? I mean, it's the narcissism of U.S. political discourse is the despair of thinking people around the world. It really is just about them and their own little, you know, and they are. They are not a dominant hegemon anymore, as we were discussing with Larry, but they are in a position to ruin everything for everybody else. And in fact, they're a completely dysfunctional setup. There is nobody there who is going to save us. Whoever wins, we're in for it because they're just incapable of managing the situation, either of them. And, you know, obviously there ought to be more choices in the electoral system in the US.
It reminds me again, we were talking about this last week, Martin, was the power of nightmares. It seems that these candidates, first of all, they're getting very personal about the other candidate and taking a pot shot at them, but they don't seem to have any vision themselves at all, anything positive much to say, certainly for the rest of the world. They may have something to say about domestic politics. But anyway, what's your take on this whole idea of potential questions over the results of the coming election in the state?
Well, there may well be, because the system itself is dysfunctional as originally designed in the 18th century. So you've got the electoral college system, which means that all the votes in any particular state have to go...
You're talking about something that's a completely different to what I asked you about. So
no, you're saying that will there be
you know the system, yeah, the system is the system. But what if the system is hacked?
It's not just a question. You're obsessed with the hacking of the electronic voting. There's other ways to fix elections, like in, one of the things they do in the US, which has started in this country. 16,000 people turned up to vote in the election in this country and were turned away because they didn't have ID. That's exactly what happens in rural America, where black people turn up.
Martin, at the end of the day, whoever's legally voting, I really like it if you could actually ask the question rather than pretend a question that I didn't ask and answer that.
You're asking
Martin, about the legal dispute over the results of the election. Can you just address that one?
Disputes over it for the reasons that I'm just explaining to you. And there'll also be moral disputes over it. It's quite likely.
We're not talking about the moral disputes. I think we all know about that. And if you don't want to answer, just say you don't want to answer.
You'll be shooting as well. So we could have a civil war in the US as they go to war with everybody else. You're right about that, Tony. You're right about that. Which side will Britain take in the civil war in the US? Perhaps you'd like to answer which side you'd be on. You know, the thing is, it's not just about, you know, the actual structure of the US political system. Let's compare it with the Russian political system. In Russia, the people who get the most votes end up winning. In the US, quite frequently, and in this country, people with less votes end up winning. And that leads to very poor decisions and for people not accepting the result. And of course, if you're going to have a situation where people who got less votes end up being in total power and putting the other side in prison, that is civil war stuff. And Russia came very close to civil war, very, very close to civil war in the 1990s. They averted it. And they've now got what is evolved into being probably the most democratic system in the world, in which Putin is the undisputed leader. And they've got the best armed forces in the world, and they're going to win World War III.
Well, I wonder whether they'll use the same old tricks from last time and say that if there is a problem with the election, that Putin has gotten involved. But anyway, look, let's have a listen now to Martin. Let's have a listen now to Yanis Varoufakis. He's been having some interesting things to say this week. He's got a new book out about the changing world economy. So, you know, we're kind of moving to look at the EU now, which is what he's an expert on. And this relates very much to the news I gave you earlier on about potential parity between the euro and the dollar that Bloomberg were announcing. So in the European Union, here is the former Greek finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, talking about how the world economy is changing with particular relevance to the political stance of Europe and the almost neutering of Europe now.
In Europe, the European Union is no longer a peace project. It's a European war union. You can see that the only thing they're talking about is common procurement, common armies and all that. And that is, given that the European Union is completely dependent on the United States, that reflects the war footing of the United States. But I'll go back to the conclusion to my previous answer. Why is it that suddenly Chinese development is a threat to American hegemony, and therefore this is leading even to a nuclear war over Taiwan, primarily? The reason is the development of what I call cloud finance in China, because there is only one reason why the United States remains hegemonic: the monopoly over the international payment system, the dollar system. Now, if they're about to lose that, they are going to lose the capacity to project power in the four corners of the earth. And they will start a nuclear war to prevent losing that monopoly. And therefore, I very much fear that these developments in China, which the Chinese have every reason to carry on and carry out. Why should they submit themselves to the monopoly of the dollar payment system? Why should, the Emiratis or the South Africans or the Congolese submit to the predominance of the dollar payment system, where the United States government can confiscate billions and billions at will of whoever it doesn't like. But the United States will nuke itself if it needs to do it in order to preserve its dollar monopoly. So yes, I very much fear that Taiwan, which has nothing to do with Taiwan, is going to become a very possible and a very likely point of conflict that may ignite such a war. So we need to take out our banners, our anti-war banners, and you know, take to the streets all over the world to prevent it.
As a European, as the head of a European movement of importance, where is Europe in all of this? Is Europe simply no longer a major player in this whole scenario as it evolves? Is there a chance for this to change? If your answer is yes, how does Europe fit into the picture you've just painted?
It is a stupid continent. We here in Europe, under the auspices of our Troika, our very shady form of pan-European government, with which I had some dealings when I was in the ministry, in the finance ministry here in Greece, they've effectively committed suicide. Europe is irrelevant, Rick. Absolutely irrelevant. And allow me to give you just two examples because we don't have much time. I could be talking about this forever. With a lot of pain in my heart as a European. First example. If I'm right in my hypothesis, which you mentioned, the book in which I have outlined it, Technofeudalism, if I'm right that there's a new form of capital called cloud capital, which is a produced means of behavioral modification, not a produced means of production, that is becoming the main instrument by which surplus value is accumulated. It is effectively siphoned off from the industrial sector. If I'm right, and therefore the powerful today are those who own large quantities of cloud capital. Who owns cloud capital? Americans and Chinese. Zero cloud capital in Europe. Zero. This is why Volkswagen is finished. It's kaput. Because Tesla is connected to the cloud. BYD is connected to the cloud. Volkswagen is not. And therefore, it's going to simply fade away. It will be like British Leyland in Britain. You know, something that some oldies like us, you and me, remember. That's one example. Second example. Imagine, and I wish it happened, but at the moment it stays at the plane of the imagination. Imagine that there was tomorrow at the United Nations or somewhere else, a peace process on Ukraine. We know who would represent Russia, Putin, Ukraine, Zelensky, the United States, Biden, if he's still capable of engaging with anything, or Kamala or Trump or whoever. China, Xi, India, Modi. Who's going to represent Europe? Once upon a time, you know, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, we would have said Angela Merkel, who was a very powerful German chancellor. Today, the German chancellor is not even in control of the German government. The French president is a lame duck, and he has completely lost it in every sense of the way. The people who are actually running the show in the European Union when it comes to foreign policy are the Estonians, the Ukrainians, the Polans, the Polish, who actually want a war with Russia tomorrow. They're warmongering idiots who are, you know, if they had a button press and destroy Europe, they would tomorrow morning. So there's no such thing as Europe. Europe has become a figment of our imagination, which is extremely dangerous because we remain the most wealthy continent in the world, a very cultured continent, a continent with 500 million people, and yet we are irrelevant. And that is a clear and present cause of instability worldwide.
Well, that's Yanis Varoufakis, former Greek finance minister. His book, by the way, just out earlier this year, is called Techno-Feudalism, What Killed Capitalism. Somebody I've got a lot of time for. He's someone who thinks that it's kind of, people should stay in the European Union and try and fight from within. But he's almost admitting defeat there, Martin, isn't he? He's saying, well, I mean, it's a war machine. The whole thing is a flop and a disaster now.
Yeah, and it's been a flop and a disaster because, as he's probably aware, it was designed by the US masters to be a failure. And of course, one of the things that Trump was going on about in his speech earlier was about he wants to make the Europeans, that's us, pay for the war in Ukraine. Because apparently, you see, it's in our interest that we're fighting Russia, not in America's interest. And therefore, we've got to pay for it. And the Americans don't want to know. Now, the fact of the matter is we're at war with Russia to keep the Americans happy. the Americans are the ones who created the war with the Russians. In actual fact, the Europeans had a very strong interest in having a cooperative relationship with Russia. And if the Americans weren't standing over us with a sledgehammer, that's possibly what we might have been able to do. Of course, the British have always played a perfidious role. We are basically the Americans' attack dogs in Europe, and we're the ones who are leading the charge for a further escalation in the Ukraine, whilst other countries are going, well, we're not quite sure about this, but we know what we want. We're on the western fringe of Europe, and we want the Hungarians to fight. Yeah, that's what we want, because the Americans told us. And of course, we're absolutely behind the Israelis when they go to war in Lebanon, as they may do before the end.
I mean, it seems to me like the European Union and in the United States, there's this sort of utter political paralysis. And I think somebody who's been writing about this sort of thing is also, whilst we're looking at the EU, before we got a couple of items before the break from looking at the European Union and in Europe generally, there is a chap called James Davis, who has written a book called The Sedation of Nations. And he here looks upon global politics, particularly so in the so-called free world and democratic politics. And that organisation I was talking about earlier on, I'm sure, is a big part of this, which is run by ex-intelligence services and NATO, which is designed to keep a check on democratic elections, quite possibly to make sure that you don't get any candidates who might question NATO standing. That's one of their jobs, obviously. So let's have a listen to him now. He looks at it as a sort of something kind of soporific, like the leadership of the Western world has been injected with some kind of psychotropic drug, which has stopped them thinking. And it's an interesting book. And here's an excerpt from this chap, James Davis, now, and his book again, The Sedation of Nations.
PHQ-9. This is one of the most powerful documents. It has been, less so today, but it has been one of the most powerful documents in UK mental health sector. Why? Well, because this is the document primary care physicians in the UK use to assess whether or not a person is depressed, and if so, how severely. So you hand it to the patient fills it in on the basis of the score, you determine whether or not they're depressed. Now, one of the major criticisms of this document is that it sets the bar very low for what constitutes having a form of depression for which the drug can be prescribed, okay? Which is why around 85% of British patients who fill this in get prescribed drugs as a consequence. Now, what the tens of millions of British people almost certainly didn't know when filling this in is that this document was created by, its distribution throughout the NHS was paid for by, and its copyright was owned by Pfizer Pharmaceuticals, which incidentally makes two of the most prescribed anti-anxiety and antidepressant drugs in the UK. So here you have a company setting the bar very low for what constitutes getting a drug, while at the same time as making, manufacturing and profiting from those very drugs. And this has been going on in the NHS for many years. So the spread of medicalization has therefore opened the door to the unrestrained commodification of our distress, creating a vast market for psychiatric drugs, now worth over £25 billion a year globally. The main benefactors of this market have been the drug companies, their shareholders, and on occasion some political allies, and those psychiatrists and organisations who've been in wide receipt of industry money in the form of consultancy fees, sponsorship, donations, research funding, and other contributions and honoraria, all being forms of remuneration that research has shown again and again bias recipients in favour of industry products. And so, while the commodification of human distress has proved very profitable to sections of the psychiatric, corporate and political communities, successfully monetizing the management of distress, the consumers themselves from whom all this profit is derived may have cause for complaint. Due to the poor efficacy of most psychiatric drugs when compared to placebo, the lack of declared conflicts of interest that are widespread within our mental health sector and certainly have been in the past, the methodological corruption within the evidence base behind these medications, the wholesale underplaying of harms, and that's another story that can be told at another time, and the strong association between long-term psychiatric drug use, which, by the way, is proliferating in society, and worsening clinical outcomes. And, of course, Robert Whittaker, who you'll hear from later today, has done some phenomenal work in this area over recent years.
So, yes, so that is James Davis. His book is The Sedation of Nations. I hope you took the irony there. Actually, you know, you do wonder, don't you, if this misuse of and pharmaceutical companies capturing the regulation and control and getting these Pfizer again being talked about there is part of the problem. But, you know, you do wonder if some of these leaders are also under a similar sort of effect. I think, I'll put a link up to the book and the power of the pharmaceutical. I just think everybody has got to be extremely careful now, because you can't trust a doctor not to be acting in a pharmaceutical industry's interests more than in your interests as a patient. It's just not possible, because the pharmaceutical industry's got such an immense amount of control. And these, by the way, many of these drugs are highly addictive, and also can cause massive more problems than a basic little bit of depression. Anyway, Martin, what do you make of the widespread use these days of these psychiatric drugs? Wasn't there a time when if people felt a bit depressed, they'd go and talk to their local vicar or priest?
Well, there was, and the people used to be hung in public as well and all the rest of it. Modern medicine is obviously a mixed bag. And, of course, what he's pointing out there is the corruption of the pharmaceutical companies and their hold-on policy. That's perfectly understandable for him to pick up on that. But it's not the only thing going on in the world. You know, we're not all going to war because people are taking the wrong drugs. That's part of it, but it's not the real reason, is it?
Well, I don't think it's anything to do with why people are going to war. I mean, obviously, it's a good way of keeping the population in check.
It is. And, of course, you know, we know during the 1980s, they were bringing loads of crack cocaine into the big cities in America. I mean, the CIA. And it killed two birds with one stone. It gave them a slush fund via Adelfo Calero to the Contra rebels in Nicaragua. So they got a load of money to buy weaponry to kill nursery school teachers. And, of course, it then created massive problems in the black community in terms of them being unable to organize and to deal with the issues, leading eventually, of course, to the showdown between Deutsch, who was second in command of the CIA, and the copper from Los Angeles, Mike Rupert, South Central Los Angeles High School, which I think is still out there on the internet. People want to see it. Drugs are part of the way capitalism works. I'm talking about
that discussion you were just talking about there. Just to be clear for people that haven't seen it, Mike turned up at a public event by John Deutsch, at the CIA director guy, and he was saying, "Your agency is in this city peddling drugs because I'm a police officer and I know it is."
That's right. So in other words, the drug industry, both legal and illegal, is very much part of the, you know, the capitalist control system.
And it's funny, isn't it? You make a lot more money.
Don't forget these are addictive drugs, whether they're prescribed.
Yeah, what I'm saying is, Martin, this is very much what we were talking with Larry about. Yeah. Is you make a lot more money from arms and drugs than you do from making a better widget.
Well, of course you do. And if it, the problem, and you make more money from speculating in the stock market than setting up a legitimate business.
And then very soon you'll be making more money from peddling outlawed tobacco. It's like we're going back to the 1920s and prohibition.
Well, we're going back to the 19th century in terms of the way society is organized in the West. Now, the problem for the Western powers and the deep state is that the rest of the world isn't necessarily going to play ball here. The Russians with their nationalized arms industry and the Chinese with their basically public sector banking set up are peer competitors to the West. Yeah.
Well, we know they're doing way better than we are.
Yeah, well, that's because they're doing things we used to do and decided to stop doing.
One of the key things that the Chinese have done is they've made sure that basic essentials of life, like transport, electricity, water, gas, housing, are cheap, so that you're not having to pay massive wages in order to get anything manufactured. It seems almost to me as if the strategy has been the opposite in the West, to drive industry into the deck. Anyway, just to finish before the break, I'd like to have a listen. I don't really know who this guy is, but I think we ought to mention it. Is the burning of churches in France, which has been, you know, so incredible over the last few months, particularly since the fire at Notre Dame. There's been a lot of fires. I think it's every week or so another church catching fire, miraculously or otherwise, in France. Elon Musk, by the way, has been tweeting about it, and this YouTuber Richard the Fourth talks about that as well now.
You may not be aware, as the media seems to never report on this, but France has quite a big problem with churches mysteriously burning down.
Now, given we're in Starmer's Brave New World, I have to emphasise that no group or groups have been found responsible for any of this yet, so I would urge you to be careful when speculating. After all, you don't want to spend 3 years in jail for having an opinion. The official line is that these churches go up for no known reason. It's like a form of spontaneous combustion. That was the case with the church yesterday called the Church of the Immaculate Conception in Saint-Omer. In the blaze, in which thankfully no people were killed, the spire burned down. Now, this is a church that was built in 1859 and survived both world wars. All we've got from the officials is thoughts and prayers with the people of Saint-Omer, and an investigation is underway to determine the exact cause of the fire. I think that's about the best you're going to get these days. Then a month ago, we had a cathedral fire in Rouen that was put down to renovation works, the same reason at Notre Dame a few years ago. Now, it's not impossible to think that renovation works could cause a fire. Accidents do happen in life, but it just seems a bit odd, doesn't it? I mean, who's doing the renovation? Five-year-olds with flamethrowers? Then you have posts like this on Twitter outlining the sheer amount of churches and cathedrals that have gone up in the past few years. But don't worry, the left-leaning fact-checkers are here to tell you you're wrong about absolutely everything. These churches haven't been burned to the ground. While they are correct in saying that this map is inaccurate and saying all of these cases were arson, they also state at the end of their own article, and wanted to hide this bit, that many of the examples were actually vandalism and theft too. So, these ideologues then, they will label something as misinformation when it misses out mild to moderate factual details, but when the broader context shows them as a problem, they'll completely ignore that. So we could at least say there seems to be a problem here. I mean, all of these churches could have just set fire during renovations by complete accident, and maybe all of the attacks on them were done by French people called Jean-François. There is information coming out of France now, and here's a press release translated into English. Apparently, a quote-unquote man has been tamed after the major church fire at Saint-Omer. The man, born in 1985, had been known to authorities for quote-unquote similar acts, and apparently lived in a hostel. It was also the case from Nantes Cathedral a few years ago, where a cathedral dating from 1621, that's astonishing, isn't it, also faced serious arson. But we did get an identity of the alleged arsonist on that one. It was a 39-year-old asylum seeker from Rwanda who was also a volunteer at the church. Now again, while we can't speculate under the pain of Starmer's Stasi on what's really going on here, it does make you think, what if this was happening to mosques in France? What if it was happening to synagogues in France or Hindu temples? If that was the case, I dare say we'd be hearing a lot more about this sort of thing, about how toxic Europe is, about white privilege, about how minorities feel ostracized and scared. I would assume then that speculation would be welcomed by Starmer and his ilk, celebrated even. However, personally, I'm pretty concerned about what's going on, not because I want to blame any group or attack anybody. I don't condone any of that. Personally, I'm a Christian, and I'm worried to see what's going on in France. Secondly, I'm also sure that many people who may not hold Christian belief but do hark back to post-Christian nations are also concerned here. They're seeing their heritage go up in flames, and we're not given any reason why. We're not even allowed to talk about it. However, I do think the strategy of Starmer and other globalist progressives across Europe is starting to backfire. We're told just to trust their line on everything because they'd never lie to us, despite lying to us all the time and seemingly not caring about us, our identity, or our historic culture. This is why they really are setting up a tinderbox for the future, in my view. These are just my thoughts, however. Do let me know what you think down below, and do consider subscribing to the channel.
So he's that's Richard the Fourth there, whoever he is. On YouTube, just plugging his own channel at the end. But this is interesting. His point, Martin, is very well made, that if this was synagogues being burnt to the ground, we would have a massive hoo-ha right across the world.
Well, it'd be interesting to see how many fires there have been in mosques and synagogues in France during the same period, because it quite likely may be that there's been quite a lot of attacks on mosques, certainly. And we saw attacks on mosques in this country not that long ago, did we not? We saw it on TV.
Trying to downplay the churches burning down?
I'm not
down
trying
there?
To downplay anything, Tony. I don't know what happened here. I don't know what happened in these various cases. What he's doing is making a general case that the Christian civilization is under attack because there's Muslim extremists amongst us. And, of course, we've got Muslim extremists in France because...
No,
France
he's not saying that at all.
There's
he's
a lot of experience.
He's not trying to blame Muslims at all. He was quite careful not to blame Muslims, Martin. You get very funny when we start talking about Christianity for some reason. He's not trying to blame Muslims
at all. Because, in fact, I think that people... That is dog whistle stuff from YouTube. That's dog whistle stuff. We know that Islamist attacks like the 7/7 attack in this country were probably carried out by our own security forces. MI6 were the patrons of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group in Manchester. Does he know anything about anything like that? Or is he just picking stuff out of the ether about...
So you don't think it's newsworthy that a church every 2 weeks is being burnt down?
Secret Services, the DGSE, were the people who set up Operation Cyclone.
Martin, you're not talking about the subject in hand. You're really drifting away here. Who is it you think that burnt these churches down, or didn't they burn down at all?
We know that there have been false flag attacks inside France and inside Britain carried out by the intelligence services in order to create social conflict. So when something burns down and they say, well, we've got an asylum seeker that did it, they could be a patsy, Tony. Yeah? They could be a patsy for the intelligence
service. It's you that's saying that this is asylum seekers, not him.
Well, indeed. But the point is I'm making here, Tony, is does that person there, does he know anything at all about Western intelligence services and what they do, their role in the creation of Islamic extremism, their role in the creation of
Al-Qaeda? You keep bringing up this thing about Islam, trying to blame it on Islam. Some people are doing that, but he certainly isn't.
No, I'm just saying he's entitled to his view and I'm entitled to my view. And my view is he doesn't know anything about any of those things at all. He's an ignoramus.
Well, he's not an ignoramus at all. He's trying to do a much fairer report than you did.
Things together and say, why aren't we allowed to talk about it? We are talking about it. We've just had a big chunk
of... Martin, he's quite right. There's been hardly any coverage of this anywhere. And yet, I mean, we also look upon this in the backdrop of these satanic rituals at the Olympics at the same time. Martin, you're talking over me, so we should stop doing that.
Christian talking points.
Maybe you're the wrong person to talk to about this, but it certainly seems to me that you've got a similar pattern here. You've got these rituals at the Olympic Games, both the opening and closing ceremonies, which are really cocking a snook at Christianity. And then you've also got churches burning down. It may well be the intelligence services behind it. It may be satanic.
I would say intelligence services who might be satanic. And in actual fact, I think this whole conversation is too obsessed with what you call spirituality and I call nonsense. The reality is that what really runs the world isn't to do with what people believe about Jesus or anything else. It's to do with power.
It's not nonsense to question why a 12th century church has been arsoned and burnt to the ground.
No, and it's not. Some people want to blow up the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We know who they are. Yeah? They're at war now. That is their plan. That is what they want to do. What are we going to do to stop those people, Tony? Yeah? Maybe your friend would like to volunteer to fight for Hamas to save the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Are you ready to fight for the Al-Aqsa Mosque, Tony? Yeah? You ready? We're going to fight then.
Yeah, so let's finish with a poem based on the presidential election, who's going to be our new emperor, from Patrizia before the break. So her ode this week is called Naked Imperium. ABC and Harris plus moderators too, for against Trump. This much saw was true. Earplugs in earrings plus makeup aplenty. Gestures and drama, ABC kept sentry. Both faces contorted, lips twisted and pursed, digging the dirt, each bad as each worst. Backstabbing, backtracking, both dishing the dirt, nonsensical nonsense with replies often curt. Both bowing to Israel, salivating, sore, no mention nor intention of stopping the war. Genocide in Gaza, Holocaust denied, streamed 24/7, this bloodbath can't hide. Race wars, point scoring, Harris attacked. I'm talking, be quiet, sincerity lacked. Abortion, contortions, this truth ne'er be spoken. Dog eaters, gun owner, no policies nor tokens. Imperium shattered, last days prey shall see. The end of an era, a tipping point be. Punch and mad Judy, the same old same song. The race to be emperor, the winner, there's none. No statesman nor woman saw in this debate. Just anger and lies all wrapped up in hate. A circus with actors. The show must go on. The empire has fallen of emperors long gone. So thanks very much, Patrizia, for that. And we'll be back after the music.
I danced in the morning when the world was begun. Heaven and I danced on the earth. At Bethlehem I had my birth. I danced for the scribe and the Pharisee, but they would not dance and they would not follow me. I danced for the fishermen, for James and John. They came with me and the dance went on.
There's a million reasons why it can't. questions still remain unanswered. There's a million questions still to be resolved. Out of 19 Muslim guys, 7 still remain alive. It's looking new, it's not a mystery. Check out the USS Liberty. It's a mystery to this day. The building fell with such precision. Free fall speed, no reasons given. Like the towers, it just fell.
Frontiers, war without tears, games.
without frontiers, war without tears. Chiangxing's is blue. They all have hills to fly them on, except for Lin Taiyu. Dressing up in costumes, playing silly games, hiding out in treetops, shouting out rude names. Tears. If looks could kill, they probably will. In games without frontiers, war without tears. Games without frontiers, war without tears.
Sound of Peter Gabriel there with Je Sens Frontier. Right at the very start, we had a rather nice little rendition of The Lord of the Dance by the Heath Mount School Choir. And then in the middle, Martin Noakes' version of 9/11 Building 7. Not a very clever hint, really, is it, of what we're about to talk about, this being the day after September 11th, 23 years, I think it is, after those notorious 9/11 attacks. Anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Do you want to just give us a little summary, Martin, of the whole... it was the project for the New American Century, they called it, and the attempt really was to define this new 21st century in terms of US hegemony and this ability to kind of go into any country they felt like. That seemed to be the message that came out of the September the 11th attacks.
Well, the project for a new American century people, those boys, they put together their proposal, as it were. And one of the things they said in that document was absent some catastrophic event like Pearl Harbor, then I can't see how we're going to get the ordinary people to, be prepared to do what's necessary for a new American century to happen. And then, of course, that's why David Ray Griffin, no longer with us, sadly, his first book about 9/11 was called The New Pearl Harbor, because, of course, that's exactly what 9/11 was. The original Pearl Harbor was a let it happen on purpose, a lie hop attack, so that Roosevelt was provoking the Japanese in all sorts of different ways in order to force them to attack the US. The aircraft carriers were not in Pearl Harbor that day. There was just a load of old rust buckets. And then they knew it was going to happen. They let it happen because then Roosevelt can turn around and say, right now, we've got to go to war. The 9/11 attack is a different version of the same thing, but that wasn't a let it happen on purpose, it was a made it happen on purpose. The deep state in the US working with their Israeli allies, they were behind that. And that 23 years later, doesn't really matter what you or I think about this. It's what the Russian general staff think about it. They know what happened. The world knows what happens. The dogs in the street in places like Colombia know what happened. And of course, it's where why we've ended up where we are today. It's exactly why we've ended up where we are today.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, I think, reflecting on 9/11 and the original Pearl Harbor. One of the books which I relied on a lot in my book, The Traitors of Arnhem, is this book, Op JB, by Christopher Crichton, whose actual real name is John Ainsworth Davis, who was a spy during the Second World War. And he even there talks about going and visiting this Dutch submarine that had signalled the approach of the Japanese fleet to Pearl Harbor as a warning. And just before Christmas, I suppose it would have been 1941 Christmas, John Ainsworth Davis delivered a whole bunch of Christmas presents to the people on the submarine, which were actually timed and loaded with explosives to go off shortly after the submarine had gone below the surface and killed everybody on board. The idea being that they didn't want these people marching around in the closing stages, well, not the closing stage, in the middle of the Second World War, saying, well, actually, Pearl Harbor wasn't a surprise. We told them it was coming.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's a lot more to real history than people realize. There's what you might call the official accounts, which everybody gets in their textbooks at school. And then there's the, you know, the more and more detailed, murkier and murkier details of all of these things. And of course, the Nazi infrastructure was absorbed lock, stock and barrel into NATO at the formation phase of NATO. Reinhard Gehlen basically negotiated himself a job as heading up the West German intelligence services, you know, answering to the British and the Americans. And that, of course, you know, that tells you everything you need to know, really. And of course, Ukraine was very much at the center of this. Stepan Bandera, who was a wanted war criminal, who killed loads of Poles, Jews, Ukrainians who didn't agree with him, Russians. He killed thousands and thousands and thousands of people. But he was protected in the West until 1959, when the KGB assassinated him in Munich. But he wasn't put on trial. He was used as a means, as Larry was saying in the first part of the show. The West was working with these neo-Nazis, in order to try and destabilize the Soviet Union. And of course, the modern Russian secret services are very well aware of all of this history. They know more about what went on than we know. It's all very well us doing our bit to try and expose these things, but we haven't got the resources. And it's their job to know these
things.
Well,
yes, that's true. But we still soldier on, don't we? Looking at 9/11 specifically, I'd like to have a listen now to one of the first documentaries that came out critical of 9/11 and really starting to show, bring out some massive anomalies. In fact, he uses the word anomaly right throughout the documentary. It's called 9/11 in Plain Sight. It's produced by a guy who lives in Montana now, by the name of Dave von Kleist. And this came out in 2004. What we're going to hear now is some of the live recordings from a chap called Mark Birnbach, who worked for Fox News. And these are some of the bits of film which were transmitted live on the day of September the 11th itself, but then never ever shown again. And what Dave very cleverly did is he got a whole collection of these from his listeners to his radio program and went through them slowly, one by one, in the months after the September 11th attacks to fish out some of the most interesting live coverage. So let's have a listen to this excerpt from this 2004 documentary called In Plain Sight now.
Let's take another look at the clips that we showed you and the testimony that was given by not one but two eyewitnesses to the plane hitting the tower.
That was not an American Airlines.
Mark Birnbach, a Fox employee, is on the phone with us. Mark witnessed this from what we understand. Mark, were you close enough to be able to see any markings on the airplane?
Hi, gentlemen. How you doing? Yeah, there was definitely a blue logo. It was like a circular logo on the front of the plane. Definitely towards the front. It definitely did not look like a commercial plane. I didn't see any windows on the sides. And as far as I knew, when I saw it coming down, I was like, well, LaGuardia is pretty far away, and that plane is really slow. and definitely very low. And I'm completely panicked. I'm you're freaking out. I cannot believe what I just saw.
We are all shaken by this. We are watching the video now back live. But the upper floors of the World Trade Center in Manhattan in flames now after apparently two large airplanes, we're talking about jetliners here, slammed into the sides right around 9 o'clock this morning. Mark, if what you say is true, those could be cargo planes or something like that. You said you didn't see any windows in the side?
I didn't see any windows in the sides. I saw the plane flying low. I was probably like a block away from the subway in Brooklyn, and that plane came down very low. And again, it was not a normal flight that I've ever seen at an airport. It was a plane that had a blue logo on the front, and it did not look like it belonged in this area, to be frankly about it. I mean, that's not an accident, personal opinion.
Again, we heard the woman screaming not once but twice that this was not an American Airlines. This was not an American Airlines. And we also heard the Fox employee giving his testimony not once but twice that the plane that he saw had no windows. So now we have to ask the question, is there something in the arsenal of the United States military that is a 767-type aircraft that would have no windows? What you're looking at is a photograph of a Boeing 767 that was manufactured for the United States Air Force to serve as a fuel tanker. You'll note that it has no windows. But now we have to take another hard look at some of the clips we showed you earlier. And ask the question, is there anything else in these photographs that might indicate that it could be an Air Force 767 fuel tanker? In this clip, you'll notice as the plane enters the building, and we'll stop frame right here, take a very close look at the tail of the plane. You'll note that there is a very small anomaly right in the tail section on the bottom. What could this be? Let's take another look at the clip that we analyzed in depth earlier, where we saw the attachment on the bottom of the plane. But this time, look at the tail section. What is this anomaly? Could this possibly be a boom port for a 767 Air Force tanker?
Well, the answer, of course, is yes, it could, and yes, it was. So this is a very basic fact from the September 11th attacks, which was completely denied and still taboo. The idea, really, that they swapped the airliners. So these airliners took off, flew around a bit, landed somewhere else, and then these drones were flown into the World Trade Center, Martin. These are U.S. Air Force drones. Which I don't imagine they're the easiest things to get hold of for the average citizen in the world, but flown by remote control, most likely. Certainly not, there weren't the same aircraft that took off, but this has really not been properly examined.
No, and if you look back to the 1960s, Operation Northwoods, which was exposed in James Bamford's book about the NSA, the NSA, National Security Agency, the plan by Lyman Lemnitzer and the other the general staff of the United States military was to have there would be hijackings of planes supposedly by Cubans, which would then lead to a big casualty toll, which would lead to a load of outrage, which would then lead to an attempt to overthrow Castro in Cuba. And of course, it was Robert McNamara and JFK who knocked that back, said, "You're crazy, we're not just going to kill people to set the Cubans up." But what was interesting about that in relation to what we've just heard is that, you know, you'd have thought if they were prepared to have a big casualty toll, then they would just use a commercial airliner with people in it. But of course, in the original Northwoods plan, they were going to do exactly that. They were going to swap the planes so that there would be pretend people who died, but they wouldn't actually die. People would have thought they'd have been killed, but in actual fact, they wouldn't have been killed.
Well, I mean, the one thing they avoided by doing that was having a plane full of relatives who were very, very closely looking into what had happened that day.
Well, I mean, obviously the people that died on the day, supposedly died or not or didn't, they did have relatives and so on.
Well, no, I'm talking about in the aircraft. if they were to have crashed in. They might have been very much more interested. Anyway, look, I want to get through the... I did an interview yesterday with Dave Von Kleist, who was the producer and director of that In Plain Sight video, which I thought was one of the best early... I mean, there are lots of others, including one he did, which he talks about in the longer interview, which will be up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk and up on Radio 4All. So let's have a listen now to Dave talking to me yesterday about really this whole idea of, look, solving this crime of the September the 11th attacks. Once you realise it's a crime, how do you solve it?
Let's use law enforcement mentality. If you're going to research a crime, you need three things. You need the motive, you need the means, and you need the opportunity. All right. So let's take the clock back to the late 90s. All right. At that particular time, how many world superpowers are there? There's the United States, there's China, and there's Russia. Well, Russia, maybe not so much. They're still recovering from the collapse back in the 80s. All right. And they weren't really a threat. And China is our biggest trading partner. Just go to the dollar store around here. China manufactures almost everything that's being sold in Walmart. So China wasn't that big of a threat. So the Pentagon, so the military industrial complex is there to make money. It's a business. It's a war machine. So let's ask the question, are they, with no threat of a world conflict going on in the late 90s, would they feel financially secure or financially insecure? I think the answer is obvious. They want a war. So now we go to 1999. And the project for the new American century, which was brought up by, you know, was created by a think tank, which was created by the Bushes and the Cheneys and, you know, all of the insiders. And in that document, they said that they wanted to be able to have a military presence in the Middle East, but they couldn't justify making that type of an action without, and I quote, a new Pearl Harbor type of event. So. We know that the military-industrial complex lusts for money and war. We know that they had talked about this with the project for the new American century. Now, another factor to throw in there is that the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, had gone to the Port Authority in New York, and they owned the World Trade Center. And the EPA told them, "You've got a pair of towers here that are dirty buildings. In other words, they're loaded with asbestos, and that has to be cleaned up, and we need you to get it done within 10 years. Well, how do you get rid of the asbestos in those huge towers? In order to do that, you have to strip them right down to the girders, and you can't work like, say, 10 floors at a time, do this area, do that area. It doesn't work that way. The entire building would have to have been stripped and then the asbestos removed. And of course, in that removal process, it would have been raining down on Wall Street. So that was an impossible task. So they knew that they were going to have to get rid of these buildings somehow. So what do you do normally if you need to get rid of a building? Well, you bring it down by a controlled demolition, but you can't do that in downtown, you know, New York at Wall Street. So they had a real big problem on their hands. So how could they figure that out? How do they get rid of the buildings and at the same time legitimize war in the Middle East? Well, it seems it would be a perfect opportunity to create an event and call it a terrorist attack. Okay, do you see how these puzzle pieces fit together? Okay, so this is something that would benefit them. Oh, and by the way, Larry Silverstein purchased the World Trade Center from the Port Authority about 6 or 7 months before the attack. Not only that, but he took out an insurance policy that would double the value if it was the result of a terrorist attack. Okay, another puzzle piece gets put together here.
Well, I mean, remember, there had already been one there.
Yeah, back in 93. Okay, they had an explosion in the base of one of the towers. Yes. So I don't think it takes a rocket scientist to figure out who would benefit from this. Larry Silverstein, we know, would benefit from taking the towers down. We know that the military-industrial complex, shik-shing, 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 they would benefit from going to war. And, of course, Everybody benefits because they get rid of these two dirty towers filled with asbestos. All right? So it makes perfect sense for them to figure out some sort of a way to bring the towers down without any blame, at least not to any blame of insurance companies or contractors or anything. They would have to have a terrorist attack. So do you see where I'm going? You've got the motive, you've got the means, and of course they created the opportunity.
So that's Dave von Kleist speaking to me yesterday. Martin, I mean, he's pretty much done the copper's job for them there. But what about the repercussions today? Because there's a lot of people that say that it wasn't even really so much of an inside job as it was done for the benefit of Israel.
Well, I think both things can be true. It's quite clear that Israel had a hand in it because the dancing Israelis who were arrested filming the first plane hitting the first building. And they were noticed because they were celebrating, and they were arrested later in the day. And they admitted ultimately that they were Mossad. They went on TV in Israel saying, yes, we are Mossad. We were filming it, but we were just documenting the event. Now, how do you document a sneak attack which nobody knows is going to happen unless you know it's going to happen? Same thing happened on 7/7 when Netanyahu got a warning not to go to his meeting at Liverpool Street, and he didn't go. And therefore, he avoided being where the bomb was going to be because they knew it was going to go off. Because the Israelis were involved in this. Now, we could get into a big conversation about what exactly was the division of labor between the Israeli secret services and the Western secret services, the CIA, MI6, and so on. And I think it doesn't make – I mean, future historians, after police have done their job, will be able to tell us exactly how that all fitted together. But all we need to know is they were all involved, all of them. The Israelis definitely, and it wasn't the Israelis wrong-footing the Americans and the British. They're all in it together. Of course,
yeah,
they
I mean, there's also this whole idea of, and well, it's not an idea, a practical thing where you've got two passports. Many of the people doing the, the responsible so-called public political jobs, supposedly overseeing this kind of thing in the United States, were joint U.S.-Israeli citizens.
Well, that's right. I mean, a lot of the neocons were undoubtedly they were Israeli citizens as well as being neocons. And a lot of them were very close to the Israelis. So in a sense, and you can see the same is true in the establishment here. Keir Starmer is married to a Jewish woman and he's very pro-Israel. And of course, these people know each other. They're all related. They've got family connections. And it's not just it's not a question of did the Israelis do 9/11. They were definitely involved in it, but they wouldn't have been able to do it without a very, very great deal. You know, they didn't get a hold of if they did indeed get hold of a U.S. military plane to carry out the actual operation, they wouldn't have been able to do that without some cooperation from the U.S. military.
No. So I spoke to Dave von Kleist also about this, you know, what is the, if there is any connection with the Israelis today. And he was pretty damning about the genocide in Gaza. He certainly thinks there is a connection. But, I asked him to just see if he could explain to us some of the connections. But most importantly, what was it about the Zionists and the Israeli state that should be, pointed out to be so wrong about what they're up to now, and particularly with the connections to this whole idea of Judaism, the religion and the faith. So let's have a listen now to the second clip with Dave von Kleist, where he talks about Israel actually being a people, not a country.
I don't know. I think we're moving into an area where we would call it 5D chess. I think the world is figuring out where Israel is coming from. They understand now there's a difference between Judaism and Zionism. Okay, one is a religion. The other is political dogma. Zionism, the way I understand it, the phrase was coined by Theodore Herzl in 1894, who was an atheist. And the concept of Zionism is to establish a land or a state for one particular ethnic group. Now, in this case, we're talking about for the Jewish folks, All right. And in 1917, the Balfour Declaration between the Rothschild families and the British Crown was basically saying, you know, what we have to do is we have to create a Zionist state of Israel. All right. Now, I remind people that Israel is not a land. It is not a country. Israel was the name given to Jacob. God said to Jacob, you know, what is your name? And he said, my name is Jacob. And he said, and God says, henceforth, you will be known as Israel. And Jacob, or Israel, had 12 sons, hence the 12 tribes of Israel. So Israel is a people. And as long as those people keep their contract with God, then the whole world will be their country. All right. That's my take on it. But the point is, though, is I got a little bit off track. I look at who these people are. Who are the Rothschilds? I would challenge your listeners to do a search. Type in the name Jacob Rothschild, and the other name is Marina Abramovic. Now, Marina Abramovic is an artist, and she does some very macabre, sick art. She's also a self-professed and world-recognized high satanic priestess. And it's no secret about it, you know. And keep in mind, it doesn't matter what you believe. It doesn't matter what I believe. What matters is what they believe. And if they believe in Satan, or at least she apparently does, I look at this, I did the search with Jacob Rothschild and Marina Abramovic, and then I clicked on images. You will find a photograph of Jacob Rothschild and Marina Abramovic posing in front of a portrait that was painted in, I think, the late 1600s. And the portrait is of Satan releasing his legions. So now I have to ask the question, wait a second. Rothschild and Marina Abramovic, they're obviously friends. They're working together. And if they're Satanists, is this a good thing or a bad thing? If the whole concept of creating a Zionist state of Israel was thunk up by the Rothschilds, is it a good thing or a bad thing? Furthermore, John Hopkins University has done DNA studies on the indigenous people of Palestine and found that 80% of them are indeed Semites. Their blood goes all the way back. That is where they've been for generations and generations and generations. However, the DNA testing of Israelites shows that 97% of them are not. They're Eastern Europeans. So the question is, who are the real Semites? Why is it that if we criticize Israel, and that, you know, people are saying they're committing genocide, I would tend to agree. As a matter of fact, I wouldn't even use the word genocide. I would use extermination. They want that land. You know, geological surveys have showed that there's $500 billion of oil and gas underneath the Gaza Strip. Not only that, but they've had plans since the year 2000 for the Ben Gurion Canal, which would go right through the heart of Gaza. So there's plenty of reasons that Israel, or that Bibi Netanyahu's regime, there's plenty of reasons why they want that land. And they think nothing of killing these people. I mean, they call them dogs, you know. Hitler called the Jews rats. Well, the Israelis call the Palestinians dogs. Hitler said, we are God's we are the master race. And yet Israel says we are God's chosen people. Okay, I mean, there's too many similarities here. I don't know if you can see them or not, but the rest of the world is seeing it. Now, I don't know how Trump is going to play this. I think he's aware of this as well. But Sun Tzu says, I hold my friends close, but I hold my enemies closer. So I'm not quite sure how things are going to transpire, but I do think that we're going to see some major global changes coming up very soon, and I don't know how they're going to play out. I can only pray to God Almighty that we end up in the light instead of the darkness.
Well, that's Dave von Kleist, the producer and director of one of the first and most hard-hitting TV documentaries on the September 11th attacks called In Plain Sight. He also did another one a couple of years later, which is much more in depth, called The Ripple Effect, 9/11, The Ripple Effect. But Martin, what he's saying here really is, I suppose, that there's this kind of upside downness to Israel. The idea really is that although they're using the trappings of the Old Testament God and Judaism, actually they're from the other side, the dark side.
Well, I'm willing to listen to all of these debates. Why not? But it's there's quite a clear distinction to be made between Zionism as a political ideology, as he said, Theodor Herzl was an atheist, and Judaism as a religion. And of course, Judaism as a religion isn't monolithic either. It's one of those religions where there's all sorts of different sects.
Every religion is like that.
Yes, that's right. Most religions are like that. And Judaism's the same. So you've got Reformed Judaism. You've got there's always been different strands of Judaism. And of course, people like Theodor Herzl, they are modernizing Jews. They just, they identify as Jews because it's the historical thing, but they don't actually believe in the Jewish God. They don't believe in any God.
There is an aspect of the big lie, isn't it? Hitler and Goebbels' big lie here. The idea that most people would say, oh, this is just ridiculous, that the September the 11th attacks could have actually been carried out by the Israelis for their own benefit in the middle of New York.
Yeah, but it wasn't just, as we were saying earlier, it wasn't just the Israeli state doing this, although the evidence that they were involved is definitely there. There's also the Christians who were doing it as well, and presumably some of them also atheists, because we're not dealing with these people aren't doing these things because they're being driven by supernatural forces. People have always done this kind of thing, to be honest with you. I mean, it's basically will to power. Human beings have always been doing this kind of stuff. So, in a way, there's nothing new here. It's the same thing that caused World War One, World War II, and that's why we're going to World War Three.
Human
beings being as they are.
Let's just move to the Middle East as we start to wind down. This week, there's a very good... Piers Morgan has been doing some excellent interviews, including one... what's that woman's name? I can't remember right off the top of my head, but she's extremely good. I can't think of it right this second. Anyway, Mohammed Marandi is a spokesperson for the Iranian government. In fact, really, he's a researcher at Tehran University, but he was on Piers Morgan this week and gave him quite a run for his money.
Hamas didn't even try to hide what they did. They made secret of their delight, their joy, their pride in what they were doing. Some of them rang family members back in Gaza to boast about what they'd just done, to old women, to children. And I'm just curious why you can't find yourself able to condemn it.
In the day and age when everyone has cameras, and there are cameras all over the place, show us the evidence. Show us the evidence. Especially in Israel, which is a society which has cameras all over the place, but you don't have footage of any beheadings, and you don't have any footage of any rape. I wonder why.
Well, there were bodies found who had been beheaded. That is a fact.
So, okay, show them all these bodies that have been beheaded. Show them on your show. Show those pictures.
How many people do you think were killed that day?
I think roughly between 1,100 and 1,200. Many of them were soldiers.
So you accept there was a mass slaughter. Does that constitute genocide to you? Is that an attempt at genocide?
No, it's like you saying that the French resistance, which was operating against the Nazis, and they go and carry out an operation, and during that operation, some children are sadly killed. So you say, so the whole French resistance is illegitimate, and the Nazis' occupation is legitimate. That's nonsense. If, as I said, very clearly, wherever an innocent person is killed, that I condemn, everyone condemns, and I wish you would condemn, because a genocide is taking place, and you are putting forward claims without the justification to make them, without the evidence to make them. I would refer you again to those websites and those reporters and journalists who've proven that the claims were inaccurate, to say the least, and dishonest, most probably.
So that's Mohammed Marandi giving quite a hard time. I put a link to the full interview. Fascinating, good stuff to have Piers Morgan taking on these people who is, the Western Empire is completely opposed to. You don't actually see very much of that at all here on the mainstream media. But it's quite a good comparison, this one, I think, with the French Resistance, Martin.
Well, yes, I mean, and that's the obvious one to make. But I would compare it more, say, to the Yugoslav resistance, because, of course, the population were put in a terrible situation by the communist Yugoslav resistance, because the Germans had said, if anybody kills any German soldiers, we're going to kill 10 civilians for every soldier you kill. And therefore, the more moderate resistance, the Chetniks and others, tried to avoid killing German soldiers and just tried to hide out and wait for something to happen. The communists, on the other hand, took the view, is we're in the business of killing German soldiers. So they did. And, of course, it then led to massive reprisals against the civilian population. And you could argue that in that case, they were responsible, you know, the Yugoslav resistance were therefore responsible for the retaliation. And you could say the same through of Hamas now. All of these people have been killed. And it's probably 200, 300,000 who are dead now. The calculations of long ago, the serious calculations of long ago stopped being made.
Well, no, hang on. When you say, Martin, when you're trotting out numbers like that, it's true that the Lancet has said that the numbers could be as high as 170,000 civilians killed in Gaza.
Yes, that's right. And I think there's clearly a hell of a lot more people died than they stopped counting when the hospitals were all bombed out. They can't actually keep a tally anymore, which is why it hasn't gone up, the official tally. Yeah. But I mean, this is a really, you know, it's quite clear the International Court of Justice has said that the occupation of Israeli occupation of Palestinian land, and I would argue all the Palestinian land seized since 1948, is illegal. It's illegal in international law. Therefore, armed resistance, which kills soldiers, and don't forget, every adult male and female in Israel is a potential soldier. They all serve in the army.
I find it very strange the way that the West is not really reporting our own citizens who are being killed by the Israeli forces. That doesn't seem to register at all. This is just to point out this woman, Asenur Agi, who was killed by the Israeli Defense Forces. When a foreign government and its citizens kill American nationals, it usually raises media outrage in the US. But Israel's recent killing of this American, including the killing of Asenur Agi, has barely received any coverage at all. The media really is, it's like a telescope. It's looking at the things it wants to look at. It's not reporting news anymore. It's almost as if it's reporting for the Western Empire and for the Israeli Defense Forces.
Well, that's right. I mean, they put a lot of effort into controlling the narrative, don't they? They spend a lot of money on it. They've got a load of people working on it all the time. It's a very important part of modern warfare, is controlling the narrative, isn't it? And of course, you know, those the weaker side have a struggle to get their voices heard, don't they? Not least because there's no, I mean, they've killed how many journalists now in Gaza, deliberately targeted, and their families. You know, this is
what's going on. Yeah, but I mean, the journalists even the journalists in Haaretz have been demanding more access for the world's press to Gaza. Strangely, the Western press hasn't been really doing that so much. Even people like the BBC seem to have just sort of shrugged their shoulders and said, oh, well, if we haven't got any access to Gaza, so be it. But the Israeli press seems to be demanding it more than almost anybody else. So another thing to report this week is next year's Bilderberg conference. Bilderberg 2025 will, we're told, be taking place between the 10th and the 15th of June in the Grand Hotel. That is in Sodra, Beläggningsholmsschammen, number 8, 10327 Stockholm, Sweden. Interesting that it's going to be in Stockholm, which has the least data and greenhouse gas emissions per capita in the world. The city's digital services and physical infrastructure are carbon-free living in large parts of the city. Even your digital equipment and screens, such as VR headsets, etc., are composted in Stockholm. So this is being held up, isn't it, as a kind of smart city, as an example to the rest of the world, Martin?
Well, I think the reason they're having it in Stockholm is because the Swedes have joined NATO, and they were helping to train the Ukrainians in Poltava how to use their AWACS planes, and that's when the Russians put in a missile which killed 700 people who were all basically NATO and Ukrainian senior military. And of course, I was reading today there have been drone attacks across the Finnish border towards Russian military facilities in the north of the Arctic there. This is really dangerous. We're right on the edge here. Sweden is being dragged into. They were historically supposedly a neutral country. They were neutral in World War II, for example. And they had a very well-developed welfare state. It was a trade union-run country. That's not no longer true. And I don't think it can be true that they've got lower per capita emissions than places like Haiti. The average Swede, they are doing what they can to kind of reduce their carbon emissions, for sure, but they're going to be consuming a hell of a lot more carbon than the average Haitian peasant. They just are.
Well, it's like Sweden has been wooed into the New World Order. Jacob Wallenberg, of course, is the representative. He basically runs the country. He's a banker that was his brother. Sorry, he's his father and his uncle, who were both very powerful bankers during World War II. And one of them was working with and pro the Allies, and the other one was working with and pro the Nazis. So they knew that the company was going to succeed whatever happened. They're playing both sides in World War II. So, Martin, Putin this week has threatened to cut off the West's uranium if they don't start behaving themselves.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Russians are obviously considering their options now, given the reckless escalationist philosophy of the people they're up against. And of course, we're still consuming lots and lots of Russian oil and gas. We're just buying it via the Indians at a much increased price. And of course, Volkswagen is on the brink of collapse. It's the main industrial employer in Germany and has been since the 1930s, on the brink of collapse. These people are used to jobs for life.
Martin, finally, can you just give us your take on, because we've got Larry to talk about it, but not you much, really. Putin's comments about this week, yesterday, in fact, saying that these long range missiles hit targets in Russia, the Russians are going to hit European countries and possibly the US too.
Well, what's interesting about that is I understand that obviously Starmer is in Washington today talking, or he has been in Washington today talking to Biden and his people, is that what seems to be happening is that Britain will be allowed to fire its missiles, because of course it'll be British personnel who will have to do this, because Ukrainians don't know how to do it, and they haven't got the satellites to target with. So Britain will do it, but the Americans won't. Now that could lead to a situation in which British military bases here in Britain will be hit by hypersonic missiles from Russia, but they won't be firing at the Americans because no American missiles have been used. So it gives the opportunity for the Russians to make an example of Britain. Yeah. What was Keir Starmer going to say when?
Would you like to hazard a guess at what sort of targets we might find that we're not, you know, they're in smoke next week?
Sorry?
What sort of targets here in the UK might be burning rubble next week?
If our missile is fired from inside the Kursk salient and it flies a couple of hundred kilometres and it lands on a Russian military base where they're doing training, for example, they'd be looking to kill some Russian soldiers. And they might even succeed. The Russians have got pretty good air defence. They'll probably shoot it down. But if it got through and killed some of their soldiers, they will choose exactly the same kind of military base here in Britain. Yeah? I would suggest Credon Hill in Herefordshire, where the SAS are based. Tiny little base. You could put one missile on it and kill a hell of a lot of people in one go. What about that? And because we'd have fired first, the British will realise as the missile comes in that it's not a nuclear missile. It's exactly the same as the missile we fired into Russia. Yeah, it's one of those kind of missiles. It's a conventional missile. But you won't have time. They're so fast, these Russian missiles, and we haven't got anything like this. They won't even have an air raid warning in Credon Hill. It will land while they're just having their tea. and kill as many as possible. And of course, Britain won't be able to say anything because the day before we'd have killed 30 of their soldiers in Kaliningrad or wherever it is. And then they'll kill 30 of ours and it'll go from there. And of course, the Americans will watch because it wasn't their missile. It's us that did it. And Keir Starmer is actually going out in front and saying, if the Americans aren't brave enough to do this, we are. I think that's absolutely irresponsible of him, and probably
maybe that's why Starmer is the leader of the Labour Party and not Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, yes, I think that may have something to do with it, Tony. Yeah, that's right.
Anyway, thanks very much for joining us, Martin. Sorry about the late start. Thanks for bearing with us all, and we'll speak to you next week. But we're going to finish this week with it. I mean, it's a bit controversial to use Jana Ben-Nun again. We had her last week because she's very bad at confusing Zionism with Judaism. She seems to talk about the Jews when really she means the Zionists, but she's got a lot of really interesting things to say. A lot of people would say, oh, we can't use this material, and I would actually in normal circumstances, but these aren't normal circumstances. And here she does, I think, an excellent job in going deeply into the what they call the Chabad cult. Now, I've seen a lot of stuff about this over the years, Chabad Lubavitch cult, but which is spelt with a C, C-H-A-B-A-D. But many of the commentators just sort of talk about it as a Jewish cult. It's not. It's a Zionist cult, and it's a particularly nasty form of rabbis who are very powerful within the education system over in Israel and have been instrumental in creating this whole generation of very racist people, very racist Zionist Israeli citizens. So let's have a listen now as our final clip to Jana Ben-Nun taking us through the cult. And also there are aspects here of this thing called the Noahide laws. So the idea is that there are certain laws for the Gentiles and other laws for those in the Chabad cult.
Those rabbis are still Judaic. They believe in Talmud. They embrace Talmud. They embrace Zohar. But they're against Zionism. They don't believe that Jews should be in the land of Israel right now. They are pro-Palestinian. They want equal rights for Palestinians. You just don't hear about those people. Mm-hmm. Because the media will never show them. And when they are in front of the presidential building protesting, they never show it. They never show it. But there are people who are Jews who dislike Zionism. And they say it's actually against Judaism. Chabad is a specific cult or branch of Judaism that was started by Russian rabbis. And you might be familiar with Rabbi Schneerson, okay? He is the historical figure. He died in 1994, I think. But he's the one who kind of put in motion the whole Chabad organization and spread of it and proselyting of it all over the world. And they have put Chabad, they have put their feet in almost every government of the world. And they are the ones who want Noahide laws for the Gentiles. Now, the rabbis who are against Zionism also study Talmud, and they know about Noahide laws because they're Talmudic. They're not out of Bible, they're Talmudic laws, okay? But they do not believe that they should be forced on us right now, that the Jews should be taking this into their own hands. They wait on the Messiah and they think Messiah is the one who is gonna do it. I still disagree with that part of Judaism, but I just want you to know that Chabad is a specific cult that I call radical, very radical. Like you heard of radical Muslims. These are very radical Judaics. Okay. And it is a cult, it is a criminal cult, very criminal organization that is involved in sex trafficking, organ trafficking, money laundering, and all kinds of sins and crimes you can ever imagine. And I want you to know that our president is part of this. As good as he sounds and as everybody wants to be, you know, pro-Trump, just please understand, behind him is Kushner and Ivanka. Yeah. Did you ever vote for Kushner or Ivanka? No. Okay, who immediately came as his advisor was his own son-in-law. Mm-hmm. They're part of Chabad cult, okay? They went, before he was elected, they went to pray to Schneerson. Yes. To his grave, so President Trump can win the election. This is called necromancy. Right. They did not pray to Almighty God. They prayed to the dead rabbi, dead rabbi. Mm-hmm. Okay? So I want you to know the powers that are behind Trump. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about politics, Democrats, as I said, is a secular form of Judaism. It's communism. That's part of Jewish movement. The far-right Republicans are part of Chabad. Chabad is also in Russia and China now, and practically every government of the world, and they're all connected together. When American government speaks of your enemies as Iran, Russia, and China as enemies, it's not true. It's not true. They're not our enemies. You need to understand, because Putin, Trump, and China are all connected through Chabad.
Yep.
Okay? So if you understand these basics, then you see who we are really fighting. We are fighting the enemy, and there is a Hegelian dialectic in place. It's a part of divide and conquer strategy, meaning they're going to divide you. You hate each other. You fight each other so they can conquer your nation. That's basically what's going on. And Chabad is at the head of it all. So, Noahide laws, just basics. We're going to go through basics. They are not biblical laws. They are spelled out only in the Talmud as seven laws. We have 10 commandments in the Old Testament. We have 2 commandments in the New by Jesus. Love your God and love your neighbor. These are the 2 commandments of Christ, but they're like 10 put together, right? Right. The first 4, I think, is love your God. And the next 6 would be love your neighbor. Right? So Jesus kind of put them all together, and he said that within you is you get reborn from inside. You transform to his image when you are born again, and the laws are on your heart. They're within you immediately.
If you love okay? your neighbor, you wouldn't covet your neighbor's wife.
Right. You do to others as you want them to do to you. So the law of love is actually the law for Christians. It's the law of love. Not complicated, very easy, because if you're in Christ, it's simplicity. It's extremely simple. And in that basic simplicity is what Jews actually hate about Christianity. It's extremely simple. All right. Noahide laws, they're also known as, and I want you to know that, natural laws. When you hear of natural laws, if you go to this website, hold on, right here, naturallawassociation.org/agenda.html. Is Wi-Fi here, or can I get on it? Okay, we're going to do this at the end. We're going to go to this website. So you understand, when natural law society, you would be surprised there is Schneerson and Noahide laws and rainbow. Okay, so when they speak of natural law, they speak of Noahide law. Law of ethics. Law of ethics. They also call it law for peace and safety. Safety. And they call it also justice. I forgot to put it in. Anything in the name of justice, morality, peace and safety, ethics, and natural law. So they kind of dress it up with all of these words so you don't even know their meaning, Noahide laws. Now, there are 7 of them, but Noahide laws have many sub-laws. Yes, there are only 7, and they seem like they're godly, but they have many sub-laws. And you know where that problem lies? It's not really in the laws, because we live in the law system. We have laws now. Can I drive 90 miles an hour? Okay. So, I had to ask her that.
Well, I'm not scared of them. If you get a warning, you'll get a ticket, right?
Yeah.
He said he had to slow down.
You know what the problem is with these laws? Who has the power of what? Interpretation.
Yes.
How are they interpreted? And who interprets them? Yeah. Is it pastors? Is it Christians? No, it's the rabbis. The power of interpretation lies with the rabbis. And this is where the problem comes in. Okay, so there are laws for the Gentiles. Okay, Jews have 613 laws. Gentiles have only 7. Come on, Gentiles, you can't keep 7 laws? You can. All right. According to Judaic beliefs, they are mandatory for salvation of Gentiles, meaning that you cannot enter the world to come unless you submit to Noahide laws, according to Judaism. We will check out their website at the end so you can see. Now, this is from Chabad.org, so you understand how they list these laws, the mitzvot of non-Jews. The mitzvot means commandments or mitzvah, the commandments.
Mitzvot, yeah.
Practice.
It's laws, you're keeping laws.
And I can't see, I'm losing my eyesight, so I'm sorry I have to use these readers. Now, number one, carry out justice, an imperative to pursue and enforce social justice and a prohibition of any miscarriage of justice. Sounds innocent? We all want justice. Innocent. Yeah. No blasphemy. Prohibits a curse directed at the supreme being. Well, I think Christians would agree with that. We don't blaspheme God, right? Then, no idolatry. Prohibits the worship of any human or any created thing. Also prohibited is the making of idols and involvement with the occult. This necessitates an understanding of the one God of Israel and his nature. Number 4, no illicit intercourse. Prohibits adultery, incest, homosexuality, bestiality, according to Torah definition. Number 5, no homicide, so no murder. Prohibits murder and suicide, causing injuries, also forbidden. No theft, prohibits the wrongful taking of another goods. And don't eat a limb of a living creature. Promotes the kind of treatment of animal life. It also encourages an appreciation for all kinds of life and respect for nature as God's creation. So when I read you these laws in a more simple way, by the way, you need to know the rainbow is the symbol for the Noahide laws. So, yes, yeah, that's the rainbow. We're coming back to rainbow as concept, right? So here we go. Simply, they have a different order on these ones. It's no idolatry, no cursing God, don't murder, no illicit relationship, don't steal, no animal torture, and uphold justice. What's wrong with any of it? Anything?
On the surface. Yeah, let's go on the surface.
It really is nothing wrong with it. Okay, no problem, right? Yeah. Now, I am going to go through Kabbalah Online, Chabad.org, and some of the interpretations of these laws. So we're gonna go through this together. So we will understand why Noahide laws are a threat to Christians according to rabbis' interpretations. Okay? In Kabbalah, the 7 commandments are equivalent to the 7 lower sefirot. The 10 sefirot through which God made the world and man are divided into 3 intellectual attributes: wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. In Hebrew, it's Kochma, Bina, and Da'at, and 7 emotional ones: kindness, might, beauty, eternity, glory, foundation, and sovereignty. Chesed, Gevura, Tiferet, Netzah, Hod, Yesod, and Malchut. I will explain soon. The 3 intellectual attributes are associated with the Jewish people, who provide the legal and spiritual interpretation of the seven laws to the descendants of Noah. Each law parallels one of the seven emotional sephirot. I'm going to stop here and explain to you something. What I underlined there, you need to read this again. The three intellectual attributes are associated with the Jewish people who provide the legal and spiritual interpretation of the seven laws to the descendants of Noah. Descendants of Noah is you, the Goyim, the Gentiles. They have what kind of rights? Legal rights and spiritual rights to interpret these seven laws, nice sounding laws, to you. Right? Now, something that maybe you didn't catch. Do you know what Sefirot is? No, right? Okay. This is what I told you in a morning session. That because you don't understand how Jews think and what they teach, sometimes it sounds so innocent and people are so happy to be on a friend bridges with them. But once you learn what is it they really mean, then you find out you have been deceived. Okay. The three intellectual attributes are associated with the Jewish people. The highest sephirot, the ones they are divided into three. You see in the beginning, attributes: wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. In Hebrew, kochma, bina, and da'at. These three are the Jewish people. They have the knowledge, the understanding, and they are intellectually higher than Gentiles. This is why the interpretation lies with them. They're the ones who are going to decide how are the seven laws interpreted for you. Okay? Do you understand me? Okay, now I'm going right now, and I'm coming back to this. I'm going to the Sefirot tree. This is Kabbalah tree. Now, this is a Kabbalah tree that is real. That's in their Kabbalah literature with a snake through it. You have to understand this snake represents their Messiah, Holy Serpent. Okay? All right. Let's go back. These are the 10 sephirot of a Kabbalah. Do you see the Bina, the Da'at, and Kochma, understanding, knowledge, and wisdom? Do you see those? Okay. Those represent the Jews. The lower ones represent the Gentiles, meaning you are hierarchically under them. The top, Keter, you know what Keter is? Mm-hmm. Corona, crown.
Oh my goodness.
Wow.
Oh my. Is this on the website? Is this on that website?
What website?
This is John's PowerPoint.
Got it.
Yeah, but no, there is this Kabbalah tree is everywhere. Now they're teaching it openly and freely.
Wow.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Okay. Corona, the entire thing that's happening right now, it's not pandemic. We don't have any pandemic. If we had pandemic, you would know about it by now, because maybe half of you here wouldn't exist anymore. Look around. Everybody is alive and well. And if they just left us alone, we would go about our normal life and nothing would be wrong. Businesses wouldn't be closed. There would be no lockdowns. Corona set everything in motion for them. For them, the Keter, the top represents, above that Keter is their Ein Sof. Ein Sof is the name of their God, the Jewish God. It's not Father of Jesus. I just need you to know that. It's Ein Sof. That's the name of their God. This is the Kabbalah. Keter is a crown that sets in motion entire process of their redemption. This is why you are seeing what you see. This is why, after lockdowns, you heard that the rabbis were secretly meeting the Messiah. Because it's all about Jerusalem and who they're going to bring there for their Geulah. You know what Geulah is? Redemption. For Tikkun Olam.
Geulah.
Geulah. Geulah. You know, I'm not good in Hebrew. but tikkun olam is their term for repairing the world. They want to be the ones who repair the world. They're going to create a chaos, poverty, famine, and all kinds of stuff, and tribulation for Gentiles. So you will be looking for answers, and they're going to have them. They will come with the answers for you. You need Noahide laws. We have the tech, see? We can cure the cancer. Oh, you have no water? Well, we can create water out of air. Did you know that this is a technology that Israel has? Yes. And they want to offer it to the world, but hold on, they're not just going to give it to you. First, you're going to lose your water. Then they're going to have the solution, but there is a price to pay.
So that's Jana Ben Nun. I mean, all sorts of problems with that, I'd agree. And, you know, it's tempting to just go in and edit out some of the problematic things she says, but there it is, warts and all. For example, she's saying that there's nothing happening with corona, that everyone would have been fine. Of course, that's not the case. Is there was certainly, most certainly was a potentially deadly virus going around, a man-made one at that. So she got that rather wrong. And saying also that the Jews' God is not the God of Jesus. Well, that's not true either, because she's basically mixing up this whole concept of Zionism with Judaism, which is actually what the Zionists want her to do. So, but anyway, so all sorts of interesting stuff there, definitely to do with the Chabad and the Noahide laws, particularly well worth looking up what they're up to. The person I was trying to remember was Candace Owens, she was talking to Piers Morgan this week. So I've got a clip, but we haven't got time to play that. I'll play that one next week. You'll have a listen to that, or else maybe I'll put the full Candace Owens and Piers Morgan chat with a Zionist, possibly even a Chabad rabbi at the same time, which is pretty fiery. It's very, very good. So we'll have a clip from that next week. In the meantime, thanks very much particularly to our guest, Larry Johnson, who did a superb job, I think, at the beginning of the show, and in taking us through what's really going on in Ukraine, which is all about these massive resources. And I'll put a link up to his brilliant post, which tells you just what there is up for grabs in Ukraine that BlackRock wants to get its dirty little mitts on. Thanks also, of course, to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and to our sterling sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download the MP3 and listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not The Beat, and also, of course, via the Telegram group. Tony Gosling Censored at Telegram is a good place to send me bits and bobs. You can even send video and I think possibly audio too on there, which is also a very handy way to swap stuff around. And Pavel Durov is paying the price for doing such an excellent job on social media. I often find with the horrifying WhatsApp, the stuff just won't send or whatever. So they've decided, oh, we don't like this clip, so we're not going to let people swap it around. We won't let people share it. Well, sorry, but that's exactly what the internet's good at and what it's for. And maybe the idea of these big tech social media companies is to get themselves a monopoly and then to decide what can and can't be shared. Anyway, this show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week. But it might not be quite so on time at the moment because we're using the internet streaming service instead of the server we usually use. But it's all there still on talkradio.org.uk. What will happen, I think, is possibly it won't be starting at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week as it usually does for the next couple of weeks. Anyway, we've been streaming live from Bristol, the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not The BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not The BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5 p.m. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
from the old school, new school.
Yeah. Problems in our country. Yes, we live in troubled times. There are far too many criminals and far too many crimes. I'm locking every window and I'm bolting every door. The tool I'll use in self-defense will even up the score. You can rant, you can rave, you can make your demands, and you can take my gun from my cold, dead hands. There are global corporations, they have billions that they pay to the greedy politicians who make sure things go their way. They tax us into poverty and we live from day to day. To them we're useless eaters, we don't get to have a say. You wanna trash this Constitution? Is that what's in your plan? You can take my gun from my cold dead hand. In every case through history, when genocide was planned, the firearms were gathered up and the opposition banned. The tyrants made distractions and the people looked away, and by the time they realized they couldn't get away, the smiling face on my TV says, we should all join hands and help create this vision of a new world order plan. We'll downsize our defenses, give our bases all away to a UN global peace force, and we'll do just what they say. Take your globalist agenda and your
new world order
plans, and you can take my gun from my cold dead hands. A man named Thomas Jefferson said there would come a day when government would try to lead the people all astray, confusing and abusing, slowly stripping rights away. To protect yourself from tyranny, there can only be one way. What part of unfringed do you not understand? You can take my gun from my cold dead hand. In every case through history, when genocide was planned, the firearms were gathered up and the opposition banned. The tyrants made distractions and the people looked away, and by the time they realized they couldn't get away, a lawman up in Utah by the name of Sheriff Mack said, we've lost our Constitution and we've got to take it back. The right to keep and bear arms when the Bill of Rights was penned isn't there to hunt or target shoot, it's there to self-defend. There ain't nothing here to compromise, there's a line here in the sand, and you can take my gun from my cold dead hand. Take your globalist agenda and your
new world order
plans, and you can take my gun from my cold dead hands. What part of uninfringed do you not understand?
my cold dead hand.
Znaš li kako boli kad vidim da sretni si, sad sa njom tražiš sreću koju smo imali kad smo se zadnje vidjeli, ali nema povratka nakon tvoga odlaska, zbog nje sve si ostavio na pola. Sad kad vidim da nam došao je kraj, sreću želim ti sa njom, ali jedno znam, nema noći kada ne stvoriš se. Kad već nema onog što smo imali, kad smo se zadnje vidjeli, ali nema povratka nakon tvoga odlaska, zbog nje sve si ostavio na pola. Kada ne stvoriš se tu, samo ti i ja u mom snu.
Is a lie.